Can we be seated so we can get started? We're already a few minutes late. We have lots of speakers to come, so. I'm Senator Ken Kulash. I'm chair of the Senate Housing Committee, and I'd like to open this committee meeting with the joint committee with the House Housing Finance and Policy and Public Health Finance Division at 1:40. The idea today is to pass information that the housing community has onto the legislators so that we have a basis to start from, so that we are kind of all on the same page about what's going on with both federal, state, and some of the local stuff. It's a big agenda. There's a lot of stuff, and we're certainly not going to be able to get into the detail we'd like to. I would ask the representatives and senator to just hold off questions until the presentations are done, because some of them may be answered, and it'll help expedite it. And if we can keep some of the questions to a minimum, because there's more presentations coming that will may be answering those questions, and we'll have time at the end to bring back testifiers if need be.
Thank you all for coming out today. It should be a very interesting hearing.
So, the initial overview is being handled by Chip Hallback, Minnesota Housing Partnership. Chip, if you'd like to start.
Okay. Thank you very much, Senator Kulash, and Senators, Representatives. I'm Chip Hallbach. I'm the Executive Director of Minnesota Housing Partnership. And to kick off today, which is to focus in on the implementation of the new federal resources that are available to Minnesota, I'm going to just cover the what potentially lies ahead. And it's the legislation that that we expect to see over the next several months. And then after my presentation, we will have other presenters who will speak to how the resources that are now available in the state are actually being utilized. So there's, with Jake's help, we'll have four topics that I'll be looking at here in terms of the what we expect to see passed over the next several months by Congress and what that might mean for Minnesota. And those are in the monitor there. The 2010 HUD budget, the extension of the first-time homebuyers credit, the tax extender bill, and then finally the Section 8 Reform Act. And I should say those are in the order of probability. That is the highest, the most probable one to be passed in the next few months is the HUD budget. The second most is the extension of the home buyer credit and so on. So with the HUD budget, there's it's passed totally through the House and Senate now, and it's being conferenced. And I should say that the budget itself overall increases revenue in the state or nationally for housing by about 15%, which was passed over the prior budget. Although we're seeing or will see a pretty significant increase, most of this new resource, though, will be to make up for some of the deficits in prior budgets. For instance, the public housing operating budget, which has for years been underfunded, will come close to being 100% of what's needed to operate the state's public housing. Also, the community development block grant dollars will see a fairly significant increase that's both passed by the House and Senate, so that's why I think that will be the case. But there again, the amount of new resources that will be coming to Minnesota and other states really makes up for the loss in that program over the last decade or so. So But where we were seeing some new dollars come in and additional dollars are two areas. One is with existing programs, that there will be substantially increased amounts in the housing counseling area and also for enforcement of fair housing laws. And then the next thing I wanted to cover is really the new theme of the, both the administration and the Secretary Donovan's HUD, and that is to do more place-based strategies, like community development block grant is, and but it's to utilize HUD's resources combined with resources from other state federal agencies and local resources to help turn around depressed areas or otherwise improve the livability of not only communities but regions. So in the new budget is first a sort of restructuring of what was the renovation of public housing called Hope Fix, which is to take the nation's worst public housing and make that substantially better. But it, in the new legislation, it's called the Choice Neighborhood Act, and there it would restore public housing and other types of assisted housing and combine that with efforts to improve school systems and integrate the various aspects of a community addressing the worst or most depressed neighborhoods in our nation. So that's being debated now by Congress, but that's something that the administration is really pushing. And then a new program, which is Sustainable Communities, which will, there will be a new office in HUD, and it will also then provide resources that would be for regions of the country as well as larger communities to do the type of integrated planning of housing and transportation and environmental improvement that is a interest of the administration. And I could just, closing this part of the presentation, which is on the new federal, on the 2010 budget, I would want to read just a paragraph from the OMB directions to all federal agencies for preparing the 2011 budget, as Congress does it. That is what's now being put together, is the 2011 budget. But the OMB in its instruction to these federal agencies says or states is that the prosperity, equity, sustainability, and livability of neighborhoods, cities, and towns, and larger regions depend on the ability of the federal government to enable locally driven, integrated, and place-conscious solutions guided by meaningful measures, not disparate or redundant programs which neglect their impact on regional development. So I think that states a theme that we'll see not only for the Department of Housing and Urban Development, but all of the federal agencies as they try to sort of steer their agencies in a way that reflects the interests of the new administration. So I now quickly and just closing want to touch upon these three others. First is the extension of the first-time homebuyer credit. And there's that the folks we work with on that lobby nationally say that some version of that extension is likely to get through. We have some people from the Realtors Association here, so I'm sure they could expand upon it. But there's proposals out there that do everything from it increased the $8,000 credit, which now expires November 30th for first-time homebuyers, to increase that to a $15,000 credit to make it available for any homebuyers. But what I think will be most likely to be passed will be an extension that will run for some number of months. June has been stated, and then phased out. But that's likely to happen, too. It's been fairly successful and well used, although at considerable expense to the Treasury. The tax extender bill, one of the things I believe the Housing Finance Agency will be speaking about today is the problems with the getting investment into rental housing that we've seen over the last year or so. And through the sale of low-income housing tax credits where the market has disappeared. In the stimulus legislation, there is a fix for that. It was a one-time, one-year fix. And just like with the home buyer credit, the problem persists even as this year draws to a close. So there's an effort among many in Congress and advocates to extend that, the put into the tax extender bill an extension of the low-income housing tax credit, which will bring new investor equity into rental housing. And as it's proposed, expect to see that there would be new equity that would help produce about 400 apartments for the state in the coming year, or bring in between $30 and $40 million. So it doesn't, it makes up for the loss of market. So many of these things that we're looking at will not allow us to expand the supply of affordable housing, but it really allows us to keep going. And so that is, an important new tool that we hope will be passed sometime early in 2010. Finally, is the Section 8 legislation, the Section 8 Voucher Reform Act that's been around for a couple of years. And there, that would basically reform the program in terms of making it work much more efficiently. It will reduce the amount of inspections of apartments. It will facilitate people being able to move between jurisdictions or communities in order to go to locations where they might have improved chances of getting employment or education. It will allow for a more rational way of budgeting and local housing agencies receiving funds for the administration of the program. So it makes a ton of little fixes to the Section 8 voucher program. The one big thing that it does, it authorizes an additional 150,000 new Section 8 vouchers, rental housing rental vouchers, which in Minnesota, as in any other state, are sorely needed. It doesn't fund those, but it starts the process that would bring the new Section 8 vouchers here. So those are what we believe are the most likely new laws, funding that Congress will be passing in the next few months that will have some impact in this state. I'll just close by saying that with all the changes with the current legislation and program, as well as what is coming up, the Housing Partnership on our website has put a new tracking program together called the Federal Housing Pages, so you or your constituents can go there to keep abreast of all of these changes that are coming upon us. With that, I'll
thank you, Chip. Is there any questions for Chip? Quickly, we've got more presenters. So, Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Halbach, you just a little interested in the Section 8 Voucher Reform Act,
yeah.
And you talked a little bit about the portability issues, and so can you talk, I have two questions actually, but can you talk about the streamlining of the portability, the going between jurisdiction to jurisdiction, and what that might look like?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hayden, the main thing that it will do is address the problem that where we have a small rural jurisdiction having some household from that jurisdiction come down to the city, particularly a suburban, may end up in a suburban community, bringing their Section 8 certificate with them, which is what the law allows, and having the problem that the rural jurisdiction has to draw upon its scarce Section 8 budget to pay the rent for that unit down here in the city. so what the fix that's in the Section 8 Voucher Reform Act is that it compensates that rural jurisdiction so it doesn't lose a resource in its community.
So if you were in Cloquet and the rate that you paid in Cloquet was less for an average unit, they would have been in Minneapolis, they would make up the gap so that they didn't have to. Okay, I got that. The second question is, I'm a little concerned, or I maybe want to have a better understanding of the reduced inspections, or the HQS inspections, and,
yes.
And you know, one of the problems or one of the issues that people, or the reputation that Section 8 has, is it destabilizing neighborhoods because the houses aren't kept up to standards of the community in which they're in. So how would that have an impact on that issue?
Sure, Trustee Chair. The major aspect of that reduced number of inspections, it has to do with if inspections are already happening under another program, you wouldn't have to duplicate those inspections through Section 8. And then also, I believe that it reduces the frequency of inspections on senior, if it's senior units, but it doesn't wholesale do away with inspections, but it tries to route out where the local government and federal government can save money without undercutting the quality of housing. And I think as they get into doing that, you know, some problems might surface, but the intent is just to reduce the number of inspections that are happening, whether they're going on with other programs.
Thank you, Chip. We have to move on. I'm sorry, we have tight deadlines and we're already over, so. Is Janet Blankenship from Minnesota Housing Finance Agency next up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jeanette Blankenship with Minnesota Housing. And today I want to primarily discuss, you have a handout in front of you, hopefully that's a PowerPoint handout, so I won't be using the slides. I want to discuss some of the selected stimulus programs related to housing. The bulk of my time, which isn't much, we'll discuss new supports to strengthen the low-income housing tax credit program and provide an overview and update of the neighborhood stabilization program. I'll also touch on the energy stimulus funding and a new housing finance agency initiative from the federal administration. I'm not going to cover current federal programs that we administer, nor will I cover programs that we don't administer, like CDBG, that do relate to housing. Okay. So the low-income housing tax credit program, as you heard last month at our hearing on our biennial budget, since 2007, it's been increasingly difficult to secure tax credit investors. The low-income housing tax credit program is a major source of equity for affordable housing development and redevelopment. Since 2007, it has been increasingly difficult to secure tax credit investors. This is reflected in the price. In a recent national survey, tax credits went from about 95 cents on the dollar in 2007 to 74 cents on the dollar this past year in 2009. This is due to a narrower investment base, low yields, their own earnings, which they don't need to have credits as much, and the Community Reinvestment Act. Now, the Recovery Act created two programs to enhance the housing tax credit program and help address this growing funding gap. These programs are the Tax Credit Assistance Program, also known as TCAP, and the 1602 Program, also known as the Exchange Program. First, the Tax Credit Assistance Program. It provides gap financing for tax credit projects. The gap is the difference between what is raised through the tax credit sale and what the building can afford as debt service, given the rents that can be charged. There's limited eligibility for these funds, which are divided among the states based on the home allocation rules. Since the eligible projects must have been awarded tax credits between October 2006 and September of 2009, so only those projects receiving tax credits during that time frame were even eligible for the TCAP funding. The funds must be awarded on a competitive basis, and 75% must be used by February 2011, while all must be used by February 2012. There's a timeline just like everything else under ARRA. And then the exchange program. The exchange funds also help with filling the gap for the project by providing a cash exchange of 85 cents on the dollar for credits that were already allocated. All of 2008 credits and 40% of 2009 credits may be returned to the Treasury for cash exchange. For the projects that do return credits, they are not guaranteed cash assistance. The funding is awarded on a competitive basis, and the projects must still meet the tax credit income and rent restrictions as if they had received tax credits. The developer must also demonstrate good faith efforts that they did try to get an investor, but were unable to. The deadline for disbursement of exchange money was extended to the end of 2011, but we must have 30% of the funds expended by the end of this of 2010. So there's a little longer time frame there. Now, the policy framework we use to award these funds, both TCAP and exchange, we have three kind of main priorities: to produce as much quality, affordable housing as possible, to stimulate the economy, and to maximize the use of ARRA funds. Remember also the federal emphasis in the Recovery Act is on creating jobs quickly. So selected projects that were closest to being ready to proceed and have pre-development activities completed were the most competitive. They were ready to go, shovel ready, if you will. The funds available, you'll see, for TCAP, there's $28.4 million available statewide, and $19.2 million of that is administered by Minnesota Housing. Under exchange, we've requested $58.6 million from Treasury, and we've already awarded $48.6 million to development. So these recent awards, we had seven developments that were awarded exchange funds, and we have about $10 million left to fill financing gaps in future projects, likely later this year or early next year. Nine developments were awarded TCAP funds, and we have about $8 million in TCAP funding remaining to fill in financing gaps in other future projects. At this point, all of the stalled projects from 2007 to 2009 are moving forward due to these two assistance programs. That's huge. It really jump-started our tax credit engine. I'm going to move on now to the Neighborhood Stabilization Program. You've heard about this before, so I'm not going to get too much into the details of what the program is. I'll remind you that the intent is emergency assistance to states and localities for redevelopment of abandoned and foreclosed homes. And there are five eligible activities under NSP: financing mechanisms for purchase and redevelopment, and this includes down payment assistance; purchase and rehabilitation of homes and residential properties in order to sell, rent, or redevelop; land banking, demolition, and redevelopment of demolished or vacant properties. Now, in general, CDBG rules do apply, kind of came in under that framework, and the funds are awarded on a competitive basis and must be obligated within 18 months, and they must be expended within 48 months. Now, as you're likely aware, the HERA legislation from 2008 spells out that states should give priority consideration and emphasis to areas with the greatest percentage of home foreclosure, the highest percentage of homes financed by a subprime mortgage-related loan, and areas identified as likely to face a significant rise in the rate of home foreclosures. So we targeted who was eligible to apply for NSP based on those factors. So we analyzed data to ascertain the highest need areas, and the Act gave the state this responsibility. We are very concerned about ensuring the use of the money that result in visible, tangible impacts on the neighborhoods, not just individual properties. The name of it is Neighborhood Stabilization, not Individual Property Stabilization. So in awarding funding, we sought a comprehensive stabilization plan. We want to know what is occurring now in the geographic region, and what changes do you want to see that will stabilize the entire neighborhood. You'll see a list on the NSG highlights page that looks at, just summarizes some of the other things we looked at. For NSP funding, I'll remind you, there was $58.8 million available statewide, and $38.8 was administered by Minnesota Housing. Now, 21 communities were awarded funds by Minnesota Housing, in addition to their five direct recipients of the funding. So progress to date, it varies. Sub-recipients, after a little experience, are amending their plans to refocus activities and shift dollars from one activity to another as they learn what their needs are and what they actually accomplish in a limited time frame. Administrative complications are delaying progress. Getting contracts signed by developers, documents drafted and approved, it takes time. Many are having problems having to make contingent offers. They're losing out to competitors. In order to purchase a home, they need to be sure that they have approval to acquire it. In the meantime, investors with cash are swooping in and acquiring those properties. As you may have heard, there's now an NFT 2 round. It is a competitive application. There's no formula funding, so we don't know how much we're going to get. We expect award announcements to be made fairly soon, so we can have an update for you next time we see you. And the total amount available is half of what was previously available. So there's $2 billion available nationwide instead of $4. And I'm going to briefly touch on energy stimulus funding. Mary Lou Teppel is here to speak more, especially about weatherization. So I want to talk mostly about the state energy program. It received $54.2 million to Minnesota Department of Commerce Office of Energy Security. And of that, the legislature designated $7.9 million for residential energy efficiency. Of that $7.9 million, approximately half is going to be used with Minnesota Housing Fix-Up Fund. We will be making energy saver rebates in conjunction with people who borrow through the Fix-Up Fund. We anticipate this will be started in mid-November, and we'll be sure that you get the press release and announcement so that you can let your constituents know how to access this funding. I'm going to let Mary Lou cover the rest, and then I also want to touch on, which is new information, just out last week, a new Federal Housing Finance Agency initiative. Treasury, HUD, and the Federal Housing Finance Agency jointly announced the administration's initiative to assist housing finance agencies on October 19th, last week. This allows Minnesota Housing to serve more consumers with below-market rate loans. As we told you before, we were suppressing production because our interest rates weren't competitive in the marketplace. This new initiative will allow our interest rates to become below market again and therefore be a viable mortgage tool for first-time home buyers to purchase homes with a below market rate interest rate. So that was a lot to cover in 10 minutes, but I will close my presentation there and turn it over to Chuck Phillips from Rural Development unless you have questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
My apologies, Chairman Gilash, but my technical abilities with the PowerPoint didn't allow me to change the order of the slides. So I don't know if we want to, I can scroll through you, or which way would you like me to do it?
The presenter is the one that needs the help, so whatever he prefers.
Scroll through, so if everybody can just bear with me a moment.
Yep, that's fine.
Go ahead.
I think we have a copy of my PowerPoint presentation in the back, along with some other program information. And I'm with USDA Rural Development. We're a federal financial agency under the Department of Agriculture. As far as our programs, not much has changed in the actual delivery of our programs. We still have roughly three core single-family housing financing options. The first one is a direct program where a customer comes into one of our field offices, makes application for a loan, and we provide financial assistance through a direct through the U.S. Treasury and so forth. How it works, we're truly geared towards the rural areas, towards typically 20,000 population or less. And there are some exceptions to that. A lot of it was based on census data, so communities such as Owatonna and Faribault still remain eligible for those programs. As mentioned, we work with those customers directly. They have to be a low-income customer. Our interest rates right now are at around 5%. We do provide a subsidy that's reviewed on an annual basis that can reduce that interest rate down to a 1% level. I live in Rice County. I gave an example of a household of four in Rice County could have an income of around $55,300 and still qualify for this particular program. The next program would be our guaranteed single-family housing program. There, the customer would go to their local lender, and then the local lender would apply for rural development assistance. Once we receive that application, we review it, and we can provide a guarantee on the bank's loan at up to a 90% level. Again, it's geared towards the rural areas, population 20,000 or less. Income limits are more of a moderate income limit. Again, Rice County family of four, about a $70,200 limit. There again, the customer applies for that assistance, and one of the benefits is still that we can provide 100% financing, and since the bank is obtaining a federal guarantee, there's not a private mortgage insurance requirement tied to that loan, so there is a cost savings under that program. Next program would be our home repair loan and grant program. Under this program, we deal with the very low-income individuals. Again, Rice County families who their income would have to be under about $28,100. It's a loan program up to $20,000 at 1%. In the event we work with some seniors who are trying to remove some health safety type issues from their home, we can consider them for a grant up to $7,500. To give you an idea as far as the scope of our funding, last year we had a record year in pretty much all of these programs. Guarantees, we made approximately $440 million worth of loan guarantees throughout Minnesota. Our direct financing, we financed about $23 million. Under the home repair program, we financed about $1.4 million, and for a total of about $464 million. And as you can see, that is a substantial increase from the previous year, and that was mainly due to the access that we had to Recovery Act funding. Under the guarantee program, we received nationally about $10 billion worth of loan guarantee funding, and those funds have all been exhausted and so forth. They recently passed our fiscal year 2010 ag appropriations, and under that guarantee program, there will be about $12 billion available nationally. On the next slide, it does give a property locator, and I do have a link to that later in my presentation. There again, we are trying to target some of our programs to the rural areas, and if you click your particular county and areas around like Rochester, Mankato, and so forth, it'll say if where you're looking at purchasing a home is in an actual eligible area. Next, we have multifamily. We do have a fairly large portfolio in Minnesota. We have about 620 properties pretty much throughout the state. Here, our assistance is with either nonprofit organizations or individual ownership. There again, we offer rental assistance, very similar to HUD Section 8 assistance, where the goal is to provide or have the customer pay 30% of their income towards their housing costs. Under this program, we do not receive a significant amount of new funding. Most of it is geared towards preserving our existing portfolio. And under this program, we work quite closely with the state in doing rehab by using some of the home funds that are available along with tariff dollars to help improve the quality of some of this aging housing stock. And on the top, we do have, for new construction, a loan guarantee program. There again, I think we made our first loan in Minnesota. It was up in Spokane, Minnesota. Here, the housing is geared towards moderate income individuals and so forth. There's not any real subsidies provided to the tenants to keep it affordable. It's more geared towards market rate housing. Some of the partnerships that we have with our housing program, again, our Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, we work quite closely with them in the area of rehabbing some of our multifamily housing complexes. Along with that, we do work with HUD, another federal agency. Here, we have a couple of different ways that we work with them. One is under home ownership. In some cases, we can finance the home through our direct program. And there's a HUD, if the customer has a HUD voucher, Section 8, they can use that voucher towards their housing costs. Another area is some of our multifamily housing complexes that we have funded have Section 8 assistance available to keep those rents affordable. And let's see, as far as the Recovery Act dollars, again, most of those were geared towards housing. We do have some other non-housing related program that we did get a significant amount of funding for. One would be guaranteed business and industry loans. We also received assistance in community facility and water and waste type programs where to provide the necessary infrastructure for communities. And there again, in both of those programs, we have access to several billions of dollars in funding. One of the things with the community program loan program, it is housing related. We can help finance new and repair existing nursing homes and assisted living type complexes. The next slide is a map of Minnesota. It gives a little bit of an idea in regards to the various activities we've had throughout the state. Some of our heavier areas as far as funding loans would be in the southeastern area and the east central. That seems to be kind of around the metro area and a lot of our regional hubs. Again, I noted some of the new president's priorities and so forth. At this point, they are listed and they have been presented at a national level, but we really don't have a firm grasp of how we're going to be administering those through our local office at this point. We just continue to hear a reoccurring message that we'll be more actively involved in assisting with community development. The next slide, as far as contact, would be our state director, Colleen Landkammer. She recently came on board. She has started at this position probably about 3 or 4 months ago. And then I've also listed some of our local offices in regards to where to contact for the various programs. Again, our national website, our state website, that's program or property eligibility website. As far as Recovery Act dollars, I've made a note of that, and the different servicing offices. And a couple of other agency priorities that we've seen a lot of interest in and growth in is some of our renewable energy initiatives. And there we do a lot with either the production of new energy sources and making things more energy efficient as far as like grain dryers are a prime example. We've done a lot of wind, ethanol production and that type of thing under these renewable energy initiatives. That concludes my presentation. Are there any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'll be very quick. I just had a couple of questions. One regarding those community loans. I was just wondering if you have, by some chance, been considering or done any loosening of guidelines that would allow, let's say, for instance, a very rural, very poor community that has desperately needed sewage treatment assistance for a long time but can't quite come up with the proper numbers. You know, that there just isn't enough local support. They can't afford to do it. Are some of those guidelines being changed so that we can pick up some of these rural communities around the state that just have not been able to qualify in the past because they just can't, you know, come up with all the wherewithal that is required, and yet they, you know, really have some serious problems? That would be one question.
On that question, our goal is to keep the affordability at around 1.5% of the community's income or median household income. So that's what we try to structure those packages at. And in some cases, we can go up to 75% grant to keep those affordable. If those projects are high on the state project priority list through either the Department of Health or else The other, as far as monitoring the wastewater systems, they can provide additional grant assistance to keep those more affordable. So in some cases, the community will take out a small loan and will receive a significant amount of grant to keep that affordable. And in addition to that, with the Recovery Act dollars, we normally get about a $25 million a year appropriation for our water and sewer programs. We have access, like I mentioned before, to several billion dollars of funding in this program. And there again, we've been able to put a lot more grant resources to some of these projects.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
Is there any other questions? Thank you so much for your presentation. It helps us with the room. The next presenter is Michelle Smith, the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Michelle Smith, and I'm the Director of Community and Planning and Development for the Minneapolis Field Office of HUD. And I have been asked to speak about the Homeless Prevention and Rapid Rehousing Program today. I made copies of my PowerPoint. I don't know if you all received them. Okay, great. Here in Minnesota, some people refer to this program as the HIPR program. I tend to call it the HPRP program because that's what my bosses in Washington talk about when they're referring to this program. The HPRP program is one of the Recovery Act programs, the purpose of which is to provide homelessness prevention assistance to households who would otherwise become homeless, many due to the economic crisis, and to provide assistance to rapidly rehouse persons who are homeless. With respect to the amount of funding for the HPRP program, there was $1.5 billion allocated nationwide. Here in Minnesota, we received $23.5 million, which were allocated to seven grantees, which are shown on the slide. And I did a pie chart, which is the next slide there, which shows the way in which the funds were allocated then to the different grantees. HUD used a formula that's used for the Emergency Shelter Grant Program. It's actually a slightly modified formula, but that was the basic formula that was used to decide the allocation of funds. In terms of who can be served by these monies, the broad categories of assistance are homelessness prevention, and that those funds are used for individuals or families who are at risk of becoming homeless. What we're talking about here is, for example, someone who might have recently been laid off, got behind on their rental payments, and is at the point of possibly being evicted. And so it's assistance to help somebody who's in that situation. The rapid rehousing activity is geared more towards people who are already homeless. And the idea, at least HUD's vision of rapid rehousing, is that this is to help people who might not have severe obstacles to living independently and can quickly be rehoused and don't perhaps need tons of supportive services in order to live independently. Of course, in order to be eligible for these programs, all participants must be at or below 50% of area median income. The model that HUD traditionally has used to address the problem of homelessness is called the continuum of care. I don't know if any of you are familiar with that concept, but when they started talking about HPRP, they talked about how now we've created two new components for the continuum of care system. The ones that you see on the left are the traditional components, and these new components are talking about rapid rehousing and prevention. Actually, prevention was always sort of an element of the continuum of care system, but I think there's now renewed interest in prevention and more flexibility for using HUD funds for prevention activities. With respect to the specific eligible activities under this program, there's financial assistance, housing relocation and stabilization services, data collection and evaluation, and administrative costs. To explain very quickly, financial assistance, we're talking about short and medium term rental assistance, assistance with security utility deposits, utility payments, moving assistance, this type of thing. Housing and relocation and stabilization services, a lot about outreach engagement, housing search and placement, case management, legal services, this type of thing. Data and collection and evaluation, you might have heard of the Homeless Management and Information System, which is a tool that HUD's competitive grantees, they might disagree that it's a tool, but it's a system through which our grantees enter in data about the people that they're serving, and it's supposed to help us better understand the impact of our programs and also be used as a tool to help understand what's happening and how people are taking advantage of different services available in the community. So as a result of these new funds, different grantees are expanding their homeless management information systems. There's also an administrative cost category under this program. If all of this sounds very familiar, it's because HPRP activities are very similar to those funded under Minnesota Housing's Family Homelessness Prevention and Assistance Program. And the HPRP grantees in the state will in part be able to take advantage of the infrastructure already created by the FHPAP program, and that there are service providers already out there that are familiar with doing these kinds of activities, and so some of the sub-recipients who will be receiving these funds already have programs up and going, and this is sort of augmenting those programs. With respect to how the grantees here in Minnesota have decided to divvy up funds, first of all, that was a local decision. HUD gave broad guidelines about how these funds could be used and then left it up to the individual communities to decide whether or not more funds should go towards prevention versus rapid rehousing. And this is the way that, as of the latest data that I've received, how our different grantees have decided to divide up their funding between rapid rehousing and prevention. And then this pie chart shows how, as a whole in Minnesota, grantees decided to divide up funds between the different eligible activities. So what's the future of HPRP? Like other of the Recovery Act funds, this is short-time funding. It's a three-year program, and right now there are no plans to, you know, renew the HPRP program. But what happened recently was the passage of something called the Homeless Emergency Assistance and Rapid Transition to Housing Act, or HARTH. And the HARTH Act is actually going to change the way that HUD administers all of its homelessness programs. But within that legislation, there were a number of elements that basically are going to make it easier for different entities to use HUD funding for HPRP-type activities. And I just outlined a few of those elements below. As far as HPRP implementation in Minnesota, our local HUD field office signed all of our grant agreements with the grantees in July. Grantees were to have sub-allocated the funds to, or obligated funds to sub-grantees by September 30th, 2009. And in conversations with the grantees, I understand most are going to start spending money now in October and get their programs up and going. Recovery Act requires grantees to expend 60% of their funds by July 2011 within 2 years, and then all funds must be expended within 3 years. If you're interested in finding additional information on HPRP, I think you all know that with all these Recovery Act funds, there's all sorts of reporting requirements. And there was a first big push in October of getting reports in. I think that data is still in the process of being cleaned up. I tried to get some really recent data, and you know, everybody's trying to use these new systems for entering in information. So it's not the greatest yet, but I would suggest looking at these three websites to keep an eye in the future how HPRP funds are being spent and allocated in particular across Minnesota. I want to mention in particular, too, the HUD.gov/recovery that will probably give you more detail on specifically the HPRP program and its implementation. So that's my presentation.
Thank you. Questions?
Yeah, I'm looking at, I think it's your sixth slide here, and the very first category you have there is homelessness prevention, individuals, families who are at risk of becoming homeless. Could you expand a bit in terms of what services you provide? And to give you a hint as to where I'm headed with that, I've read articles in the paper where people that are in a home that need to refinance it, and there was a lot of publicity that they would be getting help due to federal law in that regard. So there have been these articles in the paper, and I just last week had a constituent call that has been given a runaround by one of the banks, and they keep sending her to different people within the banking system, and she can't get an answer as to what help is available in her case in refinancing the house, because she's in a home, and she indicated that unless something is done, she will become homeless.
Okay.
So it looks like that's one of your charges here to help in the prevention of that. And do you intervene with banks to see if...
Well, legal assistance is one of the eligible activities, and I guess you could say to some respects that, you know, intervening with a bank, perhaps. However, in the description of this program, they're very careful to say that this is not a foreclosure prevention program. And I think it's geared to the most extreme cases. They'd like to say, if it weren't for this assistance, the person would literally be sleeping on the streets. And so when participants for this program are being screened to see if they're eligible, you need to take a look at their current situation, but also take a look at, do they have other resources that they can call upon in terms of family members and that kind of thing. In some respects, we're talking about the most extreme situation where I'm somebody that I'm about ready to lose my housing. I don't have family. I don't have any place to go. I've lost my job. I have no money in the bank. I'm literally going to be sleeping on the streets if I don't get this kind of assistance. So depending on the situation of that person, perhaps they would qualify, but this might be kind of even farther down the road, a more extreme situation than the one you're describing.
Well, Mr. Chairman, her situation that she described, it was pretty extreme, but I wasn't asking about her alone. I was referencing articles that probably everybody at this table at one time or other has read about people in that situation, and they don't seem to be getting the answers pro or con. I mean, in her case, they just keep bouncing her from one, I'll call them loan officers or some officer within the bank, and she can't get a straight answer. That's why I use her as an example. But I think we've all read those articles where there are people that are caught up in that, and the banks apparently are not being particularly helpful in giving them an answer. That's the first question. How do they get an answer as to whether they will get help or not? Now, the woman I talked to, it will soon be November, and that's when things begin to collapse for her. And, you know, I don't know if she has other resources or not. I know she's...
Mm-hmm. You know, HUD
children, I don't know what their status beyond that is, but she indicated that her and her children would be homeless if they didn't get some sort of an answer from the bank. And that's why I'm picking up on what you say is one of your charges. But
right. Would you
Just a point. There are so many agencies doing so many different things that this may not be under the jurisdiction here, but it would be a great idea to be able to find out which agency would be of assistance to a woman in that position, whether it be the state. Shannon has an answer for us.
Thanks. More to add to housing companies.
Chairman Kalash, and we do have later on in the presentation, we're going to probably address that very thing, particularly we have a representative with Twin Cities Habitat for Humanity that will talk about statewide opportunities to access counseling and an option. And so we should, and if we don't answer your question then, we would be happy to follow up and make sure you have the information you need.
And I was just going to add that HUD does fund housing counseling agencies that do precisely the kind of thing you're talking about, that will intervene on behalf of people who are in on the verge of losing their homes and, you know, try to work and find a solution with the bank. So, but that's not the same program I'm talking about right here.
Thank you. Representative Hayes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have actually attended a town hall meeting with Representative Ellison on this very issue, so I'll be interested in what Habitat said, because when we talked to them, they were just as perplexed and were beating their head up against the wall on this very issue that Representative Carlson is talking about. So it'll be interesting to see if there's further developments, but that is a real issue, and we should really be thinking about how do we get people help. Folks are not getting help through the banks on the loan modification program that people are talking about. I just had a quick question, though. That was a comment. This is a quick question about on page number 4 was the slide that spoke to the proposed distribution of HPRP funds in Minnesota, mm-hmm. and the difference between the prevention and rapid housing. Mm-hmm. And so I was most interested in the graph or the line that looked at Hennepin County spending most of their allocation in prevention and less in rapid rehousing, and then Minneapolis being about equal. Can you explain that just a little bit, and then even a little detail as to who the county is serving versus the city?
You know, I'm the wrong person to be asking, because I'm not the one who came up with these distributions. The people that you need to be talking to are representatives of Hennepin County and the city. What HUD does is we give them the choice to take a look at their own particular needs in the community and make a decision. Too, I know in talking to different counties, people too were talking about, for the rapid rehousing program, for example, you have to use HUD's definition of homeless, which is a somewhat, some people might argue it's a strict definition of homelessness, and that the way that communities were, the type of people that they were serving didn't fit into that real specific definition. And so because of that, they decided to use more funds, for example, for prevention. I've heard all sorts of different kinds of rationale about why people are using funds in a different way, but I really think that I'm the wrong person to be explaining those differences, because it was not a HUD decision. It was a local decision.
Mr. Chair, just one follow-up. Yeah. Do we know, I know that the Hennepin County folks that distribute out the housing dollars, who at the city would we be talking to? Who is administering the money from the city? What is the entity?
Okay, I can get you that information.
Okay.
Provided. I think that would be the best bet to get you the name and stuff, so I'll...
Thank you, I appreciate it.
Yeah.
Any other questions? Thank you, Ms. Smith.
Okay,
appreciate
thank
it.
You.
Next speaker is Mary Lou Chappell, Office of Energy Security. Thank you for coming.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mary Lou Chappell. I'm here on behalf of the Office of Energy Security. I'm the Weatherization Supervisor for the state of Minnesota. I'm going to talk a little bit about the state energy programs. We have a graph up here, a pie chart that shows you the money that the Office of Energy Security receives from the Department of Energy for state energy programs. And as you can see from this, we receive money for energy-efficient conservation block grants. These are competitive grants. We received money, well, we didn't receive, it came through us to the formula grants to the cities and counties. We received $54 million in state energy programs, $5 million in rebates, and $132 million in weatherization. I'm going to talk briefly. In your packet, you should have a chart that looks like this. I'm going to refer to that to talk about the state energy program. As you can see from that chart,
we divided this into monies that went to commercial, industrial, and small businesses, and also at the bottom, local and government, the local governments and public schools. And the one that I'm really going to focus in on for this committee is the one that's on residential housing. And there are really three programs that have developed enough to report on. The first one Jeanette talked about, and that's the $7.9 million that, that we have added to go with their fix-up loans, that really we are looking for energy-efficient measures, such as it says here, insulation, air sealing, furnaces, boilers, and windows. So that is, we are pleased about that and happy to work with MHSA on that program. The other two programs are, first of all, the re-energize program that is actually, as far as we know, working out there. We are getting reports of it. And we have contracted with the Builders Association of Minnesota to carry out this grant. They used focus groups to determine what measures would be the most effective and bring in the best savings to investment ratios for the measures that were done under that program. The contractors that participate in that must go to training and must be trained how to do this properly. We expect that between 1,000 to 1,500 households will be affected with this money. There is a limit on how much they can get, and it's either $2,500 or $4,000, depending on if they use air sealing measures in the house, which is the most energy efficient measure that we can do. There is extra money if they need for health and safety. If they're orphaning a water heater, they can use extra funds for that. So no money has been out yet, but it is underway, and we expect that to continue and be finished pretty quickly, actually. The other program in this section is the Energy Star appliance rebates. That has a March rollout, we believe. We expect about 25,000 households to, actually 25,000 appliances to be purchased with this rebate. This is limited to white appliances only, and they must be Energy Star, as it says here. And then I'd like to devote the rest of my time to talking about the weatherization program. As you are most likely aware, the weatherization program for the last several years has had approximately $10 million a year. And with that money, we have weatherized around 4,000 houses each year. The ARRA money has allowed us, over the three-year ARRA period, to weatherize an additional 17,000 households. The ARRA bill, the ARRA law, actually also increased the amount we could spend on each household from $3,000 to $6,500. So the numbers, if we had kept it, the $3,000 would be much larger, but we believe we can do better energy savings with this, and we're pleased about that, and have been asking for that increase for some time. Because we also have to monitor 5% of the work that's done under this grant, we have increased the number of monitors that we have in the field from 3 to 9, and also have added fiscal monitors to make sure that all of our sub-grantees, service providers, are doing a proper job of keeping track of the money. There is a report in recovery.com. By the way, reporting has been as Jeanette pointed out, reporting has been a barrier to getting work done, because the reporting requirements have been very strenuous and have changed. So we've spent an enormous amount of time preparing for the reports. As of the end of September, we had spent a fair amount of money on administration and equipment and ramping up to do the work. Although we received the funding, 10% of the funding in April, we could not spend those funds. We received another 40% later on, but could not really spend those funds until another barrier, the Davis-Bacon requirement of the ARRA grant, the ARRA law, was put into effect, and we got actually the weatherization wages review from DOL. So, in actuality, we really started the program in earnest at the beginning of September. But even at that, by the end of September, we spent about $2.6 million in production expenditures. The service providers that include CAP agencies, tribes, CDCs, and a nonprofit have hired approximately 200 people to do this work, and they expect to hire just under 100 more throughout the duration. They've trained over 300 people, about 350 actually, and they've trained 150 new people, and they will continue to do that, and we actually have provided training for them and have subcontracted with people to develop curriculum for training for people who have not previously been in weatherization. Obviously, many haven't, so that they can get up to speed really quickly to perform the duties under this. Another barrier to the weatherization program is the state historical preservation office, not them in particular, but the federal law requires that any house over 50 years old go through a review to have work done on them. We have been working with our state civil office to perhaps even hire someone on our staff to work with them so that this can be expedited so that it doesn't slow down the process. It takes about 90 days from the time a household is audited to determine what work can be done on it till the time it's completed. So there is a cycle to this, and we expect to see the numbers of completed units to be tripling by the end of December. Right now, we doubled from September to the end of October. We're just getting our numbers in. We have another reporting that needs to be in tomorrow. We have about 1,700 houses in progress, and we actually, because we couldn't use those RF funds quickly enough, we actually find that our service providers have been spending their DOE regular money. Some of them are nearly out of that money, and we have actually completed nearly half of what we would do in a whole year at this point of regular DOE money. And that's all I have. Thank you.
Representative Clark.
Thank you. Could you just give us an update on the, I guess it was the big hope that there would be people hired by this program, by the air funds that didn't have, you know, that we're not traditionally in the kind of weatherization programs you mentioned that just now. How are we doing with that in terms of low-income people of color?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you.
Didn't hear me at all?
Yeah.
Okay. There was a lot of hope, I believe, that there would be jobs that are available and created by this program for low-income people and people of color. How are we doing with that?
Actually, I believe we're doing well. We don't have any numbers of that. We know in the procurement process in the metro area in particular, and the outstate too, they have addressed those issues in the procurement, and I believe the metro area, one of our largest agencies, had a 30% response of minority and women-owned businesses responding to that procurement.
Excuse me, and that was 30% against the goal of what?
There is no goal. We don't have a goal.
Are there some benchmarks that we
No, have? We do not have one. The state actually prohibits that, I believe.
Could you just give us an idea about distribution of weatherization funds throughout the state currently or how it's rolling out?
Mr. Chair, distribution as far as the funding for each area,
it's
done by allotment, and I can get you that. I don't know it off the top of my head because each agency covers several counties, and it's done by population, so it's done on a formula that's given to us by the DOE.
Okay, thank you. Senator Rummel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have two really quick questions. The first one, under residential, the renewable energy and ground source heat pump rebates, you've got this marked as pending.
Yes.
You know when those funds
on are? On the state energy program?
Yes.
Mr. Chair and Senator, yes, those are programs that for one reason or another have things that, particularly in that one, there's a NEPA issue. Many of these are other federal things that have shown up that we have to take care of before some of these can actually be, the RFPs can actually be written.
We have constituents here in Minnesota who, winter comes quickly.
Yes.
And yes. So this one is pretty critical for us. The second one I'm concerned about is the Emerging Renewable Energy Industries Grant Program up above in the commercial. You say those funds are available now. Who applies for those? We've got a bill for a couple of small businesses in my community that are interested in those funds.
I'm sorry, I will have to get you that information. One thing you can do that is, and Shannon went to that slide, is I'm showing here the cover for our website, and you can go click on the stimulus button over there, and it will speak to each program. And I will be happy to have someone contact you on that.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Representative Saylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that's simple. You did address the Davis-Bacon situation, and I want to find out, you know, have it very clear. Are our CAP organizations now able to hit the road running? Because many of them talked to me about their extreme distress about the fact that they were ready to go and they couldn't go because of Davis-Bacon being one of them, and some of these other federal things that were kind of holding up the show. Are they ready to be putting insulation in homes today?
Mr. Chair, Representative Saylor, yes. We had Davis, we did not get our weatherization wage determinations until late August. And then we had training that we provided for all of the agencies on September 23rd. And since that time, they've been ready, and now that they have that information and they know what the wage is, they are moving forward very quickly.
Just a follow-up. And they're not held back by something else? There isn't something else that has since then showed up?
Well, the SHPO is a little bit, but we're not being held back by that, and we're moving on, and we will work something out with that to make sure that it doesn't hold us up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have one other question on the same thing, and that is, I'm just wondering, have you noticed you address staffing needs within your own organization and other organizations that are dealing with getting this funding out? Are you also identifying in any cases places where at local level staffing is a problem, that there isn't somebody ready to take things at any of the local levels? Are you identifying that at all, or seeing that coming up? That not within your own agency, although I'm sure there are times when you wish you had four more people, but outside of the state agencies.
Mr. Chair, Representative Saylor, I have to say that I've been very impressed with the service providers and how they've addressed this issue. And when I meet with them, which I do on a bi-monthly basis, they tell me that they have the people they need. They have brought on many contractors, and they have been training them, and we have been training them. And at this point, the fact that they have reported to us that they need to hire under 100 more people, I believe that they're well staffed for where they are now. They realize that they may have to add people as it moves on. But for now, I'm comfortable with where they're at and how they're working. And we are out there monitoring now.
Thank you. Jeff? Representative Hayden, excuse me.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
No, you're ready.
I just wanted to follow up a little bit on what Representative Clark was talking about with respect to DBEs, our inclusionary policies, with respect to the money that goes out for weatherization. And so you said that there is no benchmark. Can you talk a little bit about what the policy is to include more people in getting these contracts? Are I don't have it in front of me, but I remember Representative Champion worked pretty hard, and I just don't have it in front of me to remember exactly where it went in statute. But I know that we've had a lot of conversations, we've had a lot of discussions, not only with your office, but directly with the CAP agencies about this issue. So, can you talk about the conversations that we've had, or the policy direction that we've gone forth with respect to this issue?
Mr. Chair, Representative Layton, the procurement policy, we have a state procurement policy in our policy manual, and it essentially says they have to follow the DOE guidelines for it, so it's silent except for that, and that they need to develop their own procurement policies. And I would suggest if you have more questions than that, there's another meeting, another legislative hearing tomorrow that may be addressed more at. But we have done what we can to encourage people to make sure that they are inclusive in their in how they write their procurement policies.
So, Mr. Chair, if I may, so the DOE is silent on this issue. Is that what you said?
Yes.
Okay. And the state is also silent on this issue? Is that what you're saying?
Following the DOE rules, yes.
Okay. Thank you. I just wanted to clarify that.
Thank you. Was there any other questions?
Thank you. And I think to that point, I think there were some issues in which some of the legislation we passed this time around, which talked about veterans and veteran-owned businesses, that we were trying to get some of the same advantages that the DBEs have. I think it goes to the core issue of quotas, which I think the Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court, heard a couple of years ago in talking about the constitutionality of quotas. I think if I'm correct, the whole issue with the DBE is that there's a 6% advantage that is given for the bidding process for disadvantaged businesses. And so there's, you know, it's not that there should be any quotas given per se on those issues. And if there are, I'd like to know, because I think there are certain groups that we need to advocate as well, as not just the DBE, but some of the other groups, which kind of goes back to the whole issue of, do we have a level playing field? Are we trying to give other people a greater advantage? For what reasons? And when are those issues resolved? So I guess, just to that point, I just wanted to say, if there's other hearings on it, I'd like to be available to be engaged in that, because I would present the other side of the coin as well.
Thank you. I think that's all. Thank you for your testimony. Next, we are going into intersect with health, affordable, and green housing, a Minnesota case study. And I have Joan Cleary to introduce Dr. David Jacobs. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, members of the committee, the caucus, and others who are gathered here this afternoon. It's my pleasure to join you for this informational briefing, and in just a few minutes to introduce our keynote speaker, Dr. David Jacobs. First, a word about our foundation. As a grant maker, we are focused on key social, economic, and environmental determinants of health that have a lot to do with the health of our communities around the state. And this means factors like early childhood development, housing, the environment, social connectedness. And in this way, we complement the work of the health plan by focusing on powerful determinants of health that go beyond genes, that go beyond our lifestyle choices, and that go beyond our access to care and coverage. Now, we know that many preventable health conditions have their roots in housing and neighborhood conditions. And I think you'll find that Dr. Jacobs' presentation demonstrates how investments in green, affordable, healthy housing are also investments in health and our health interventions. So, with that, a few words about Dr. Jacobs, who's a leading expert in this field. He directs research for the National Center for Healthy Housing, based in Columbia, Maryland. And he and the National Center work to control childhood exposures to lead, to mold-induced illnesses, carbon monoxide poisoning, and other influences on health while preserving affordable housing. He's the principal author of the President's Task Force Report on Childhood Lead Poisoning and numerous scientific articles in this field. Now, tomorrow our foundation is going to recognize Dr. Jacobs for his national leadership and for his role in an important project on healthy housing here in our state in Worthington, Minnesota, where he led a study of the green rehabilitation of an affordable housing complex. He's leading the research that is tracking the health impacts of the renovation on residents, and it's the first long-term national study of this kind. So, please join me in welcoming Dr. Jacobs.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Joan, and thank you, Mr. Chairman, and the other members for the opportunity to appear before you today.
Before I get into my talk proper, I did want to call to your attention a handout that looks at two bills, healthy housing bills that are moving through Congress, one of which is co-sponsored by Senator Franken. We're hopeful that those bills will be successful and will advance this this issue. In the brief period I have with you, this is what I want to cover, a very brief historical overview, sort of pose a policy dilemma in terms of understanding housing and the shared commons and whether or not individual housing structures are part of our overall infrastructure, share with you the scientific evidence of the association between housing quality and health, and more importantly, when we intervene in housing, whether the evidence is clear from both a clinical and an environmental health standpoint that there are benefits. And then briefly discuss some of the links between healthcare reform, health containment, and investment in housing. And then spend most of my time actually talking about this groundbreaking study that we just completed in Worthington, Minnesota. Now, this is not a new idea. Over 100 years ago, Florence Nightingale made this observation: the connection between health and the dwelling of the population is one of the most important. And in fact, if you go back 100 years, our first housing laws in this country were designed to control public health epidemics. Cholera, typhoid, and tuberculosis were, in some respects, housing-related. Now, clearly, improved medical care had a lot to do with conquering those diseases, but it was also a housing intervention that had a great deal to do with it, something we now take for common, indoor plumbing. That had a lot to do with the ability to wipe out those diseases. This is a depiction of miasma. It was sort of perceived to be an odor that stalked the neighborhoods of the poor, and it's before we understood that germ theory was really the causal agent of some of these sort of acute respiratory illnesses. So the lesson from the late 19th century was that housing and health professionals had to collaborate. And we had something called the sanitation movement, which was very successful. We found if you reduced crowding, provided fresh air ventilation, improved sanitation, that you could go a long way to wiping out those diseases. However, that connection atrophied over the last century. The housing folks became more financially oriented, and the public health folks became more medically treatment-oriented and less preventive-oriented. And it wasn't until the lead poisoning experience in the 70s and 80s that it became clear that a collaboration between those two worlds was necessary to look at and conquer some of the more chronic diseases that we face today, such as asthma, mold-induced illness, and lead poisoning. So we need to reestablish the links. I've given you some of the list of folks who need to think through how we can better collaborate and speak each other's languages. But it seems to me that some of these efforts have important policy implications for those of you in government to try and figure out what do we need to do from a policy perspective to make rational choices and achieve the biggest bang for the buck in both worlds. So here's our dilemma. Are, in fact, our houses part of our shared commons? Many of you know that many of our environmental laws are based on the idea that for those things we share in common, there's a public responsibility to oversee how those are used so that there's equitable opportunities. So here's one definition of commons. It's everywhere. It's the air we breathe, the words we speak. It's tangible and intangible, ancient and modern, local and global. It's everything we inherit together as part of a community as distinct from things we inherit individually. And then here's the kicker. It's everything that is not privately owned. So most houses in this country are privately owned. And then the question becomes, if you're looking at health conditions in a housing in houses, does that mean that we're all on our own to figure out what needs to be done to correct those health hazards? So this is a picture of the Cuyahoga River in Cleveland back in the 60s. It caught on fire. This was clear. The public got it that this river was something that we shared. So that's why we have the Clean Water Act. That's why we passed the Clean Air Act. But in the housing world, we're far more atomized. While we do regulate some aspects of the commons, such as that are privately owned, such as the workplace and child labor laws, the question is, where does green building design fit into this overall public responsibility? These are data that show from the American Housing Survey that show that we continue to have disparate conditions by race and ethnicity in substandard housing. You can see that non-Hispanic blacks and Hispanics are far more likely to reside in housing units that have moderate or severe physical problems. This is an article I published just last year, actually, that shows that over the last 30 years, we continue to have health disparities that are quite significant that, frankly, haven't budged much. And then these are data that show that people who live in moderate physical hazards in houses also has not budged much. The curve remains unchanged. Now, contrast those two pictures with this one. This is what the nation experienced with lead poisoning. And what it shows is that both population exposures to lead, these are blood lead levels from the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey going all the way back to 1975. And you can see that the disparities narrowed and population exposures also declined. So why did that happen? Why do we have these two different pictures? And essentially, it's because the nation took action. We adopted a large number of policies and programs to deal with lead exposures, including lead in food canning, lead in gasoline, lead in new paint, and then finally lead in existing paint. So the black line on this slide is the average population blood lead level, or rather the percentage above 10 micrograms per deciliter, the CDC level of concern. So some people look at this slide and say, well, you're done. You've solved the lead problem. And I just want to hasten to add that we still, in fact, are 100 times over where our ancestors were, and there's still over 24 million housing units in this country with lead paint hazards. Not just lead paint, but lead paint hazards. So we still have a long ways to go. But this is what we did in the 90s. We built the infrastructure necessary to combat that disease. Back then, we had no health-based exposure limits for paint, dust, or soil. There was no standardized way to go about inspecting houses for lead paint problems. Some paint removal methods actually turned out to do more harm than good. That's why the research is so essential. So those practices are now banned. Laboratories analyzing specimens for blood or for paint had no quality assurance program. There was no performance criteria for instruments. No trained inspectorate. Of course, back then it was legal for a landlord to conceal information they had about lead paint hazards in a housing unit when it came up for a reoccupancy or sale. That's now illegal. So all of this has been solved. So what we decided we would think about was, well, how to transfer the lessons that we learned from the lead paint experience to other housing-related diseases and injuries. So I want to turn to that connection and do two things with you today very briefly. Provide you with some of the evidence that housing condition is in fact related to health by citing some work I did with the World Health Organization, and also evidence that if we improve housing investment in specific ways, we can in fact have demonstrable improvements in health outcomes that make sense both financially and from a perspective of preventing suffering. Of course, housing, I think Blue Cross Foundation really has championed this concept here and nationally, that housing is a key component of a social determinant of health that we need to think about as we have this healthcare reform debate. Now, this is a study out of London of about 450 housing units where they move, and of course in England it's easier to do this sort of analysis because they have a single-payer type system, but they move 450 people out of the houses, rehab them, move the same people back in, and then looked at their medical costs. And surprisingly, astonishingly, I should say, it went down by a factor of sevenfold. Now, not all of that is necessarily tied to housing. They did some other things as well. But clearly, improved housing had an important component. We haven't had a study like that here until recently. This is the cover of the World Health Organization report that I attended, that we worked on in Bonn. And I'm not going to have time to go through all this, but we assessed, I'd say, 500 or 600 scientific studies to try and determine the strength of the evidence for each of these factors, such as heat and cold, energy efficiency, radon exposure, social factors such as multifamily housing, housing quality, chemical factors such as environmental tobacco smoke and lead, and biological factors having to do with asthma, humidity, mold-induced illness, and so forth. So these are the ones for which we found sufficient evidence. We also grouped a number of characteristics that had some evidence that was suggestive of a health effect, but which we did not regard as conclusive. And you see them listed here. I hope you can read these. If not, we'll make them available. But still, things like, for example, regulating the amount of fresh air in building, you would think would be obviously related to health outcomes, but we couldn't find clinical or environmental evidence to show that there was a causal path. And then we found also for two things, particulate matter and lighting, there was not sufficient evidence to show an impact, an influence on health. So then in December of 2007, CDC with us convened a panel of experts to look not only at these associations between housing conditions, but interventions in housing, that is housing repairs in the vernacular, that had a demonstrable effect. And we grouped them into biological, chemical agents, water and sewage treatment, injury prevention, and then these community-level effects. And this is what we showed was effective. We also had other categories of things that needed further research, further field testing, and some interventions which we know are ineffective. So this is what you see here, and I know that on the asthma one, which I think is probably an integrated pest management, it's a mouthful. And multifaceted tailored asthma interventions simply means that you target the interventions in the housing to what the child or the adult is specifically allergic to. So, for example, if you're allergic to dust mites, or let's say cockroaches, you would focus your attention on pest management and perhaps not so much on the bedding. But that evidence is very clear. It turns out that radon, which is almost an entirely housing-related disease, the radon-induced cancer is the second leading cause of lung cancer in this country following tobacco smoke. We did radon mitigation in Worthington, and I'll share those results with you in a moment. Integrated pest management, there's overwhelming evidence now that both asthma can be reduced from 37% to 9% in this particular study. There was a lower amount of insecticides that were used and more effective. So hopefully we're no longer doing what this mother is doing. She was attempting to protect her child by spraying DDT back in the 50s over the bedding. We now sort of look at that with raised eyebrows like you're doing, saying, how could they do that? But that back then, that was perceived to be an effective means. We now have integrated pest management, which is a fancy way of saying, let's think like the pugs and go after how they get into the properties and deny them harborage and nutrition so that they're no longer a problem. A number of studies have showed benefits from multifaceted asthma interventions in regard to reduced symptom days, reduced trip to the emergency room, that is reduced uses of medical care, and we know that once you go to the emergency room, the costs are much higher than managing the disease instead. Improvement in missed school days and improved quality of life. We are currently spending at least, this is probably an underestimate, at least $18 billion a year to medically manage asthma cases. This evidence suggests that if we make certain improvements in housing, we could go a long way to reducing those costs if we were smart about it. This is a study out of the Hope 6 public housing. You heard about that previously. Hope 6 was sort of the worst of the nation's public housing stock. They looked at two things, doctor-diagnosed asthma and self-reported general health. And what you see here is a clear dose response, moving from the terrible public housing to the non-poor, basically the right column is all of the U.S. housing. And you see that health goes up as housing quality improves and doctor-diagnosed asthma goes down. Again, clear dose response. Injuries turn out to be, if you exclude automobile accidents, the home environment is the second leading place where fatal accidents occur for children under 19 years of age. And the same thing occurs for, these are data for non-fatal injuries as well. In terms of interventions that we know work, working smoke alarms, and I'd say installed smoke alarms, just giving them away we found is not as effective as making sure that they're installed and working. Four-sided pool fencing as opposed to three-sided pool fencing, and then having manufacturers preset temperatures so that they are not hot enough to cause scalds and burns. Basically, that means 120 degrees and no higher. So here's the policy dilemma. Right now, from a building owner's perspective, it makes little sense to invest, to make health investments in housing because they're unlike other home improvements. If you put a new roof on your house or a new furnace, you get some of that value back when you sell the house. If you do lead abatement or asthma mitigation, the housing market does not recognize that price. It doesn't know how to monetize it. And so you don't get that money back. And therefore, we have this inefficient cost shifting going on now where the burden of disease is picked up by our medical care sector when much of it, or some of it at least, could be prevented by adequate investment in housing. So that's the policy dilemma that I wanted to put for you today. What do we need to do to make transparent? This is sort of the bad news. The good news is that there are some systems now that are looking at labeling houses so that we have informed consumers. And one of those is the green healthy housing system, and that's what I want to move to now. So if you take a common housing intervention, window replacement, you'll see that people will look at this blue bar, the upgrade cost. How much does it cost to put the windows in? How much of that value do I see in the market value? If they're close, I might replace the windows. But the health benefit is entirely hidden. And in fact, it dwarfs these other two components. We know the windows have the highest amount of lead dust and lead paint on them and from any other building component. We also know that it's related to moisture incursion, which has to do with asthma. So rationalizing this externality is key. So let me quickly turn to the study in Worthington. Many of you know about the Green Communities criteria, so I won't belabor this. It's 8 components. Integrated design is simply a fancy way of saying, let's make sure we have all the professionals at the table who can weigh in, including health and housing folks, looking at neighborhood and site and so forth. And number 7 here is the part that my group wrote having to do with the healthy living environment. I would note that this particular system requires a number of these health systems, whereas other systems like LEED, for example, just give you extra points. Anyway, we used a detailed health questionnaire that was drawn from the Centers for Disease Control's National Health Interview Survey, which is provided to 50,000 households annually. We did resident training on what they could do. It's not just enough for us to modify these homes, but what role do residents need to take to make sure their homes are maintained properly. A detailed visual examination, and we looked at a number of ventilation and environmental methods. So these are the 7 key principles of healthy homes that incorporate the training: dry, clean, pest-free, ventilated, safe, avoiding chemical contaminants, and then keeping it properly maintained. And I'll skip through the visual assessment. So this is what we did in these properties. In ventilation, we provided fresh air for the first time. What a revolutionary concept. That complied with the American Society of Heating, Refrigeration, and Air Conditioning Engineers Standard 62. We used low volatile organic compound adhesives for the paints and coatings. We did radon testing, and there's a lesson to be learned with that I'll get to in a moment. Before rehab and after construction, integrated pest management, non-smoking was enforced in common areas, and increasingly I would point out HUD just issued a new policy guidance to promote non-smoking in public housing as well. No carpets in wet rooms to control mold issues, Energy Star rated bath exhaust fans and also kitchen exhaust fans, and then proper surface drainage away from the foundation so that we avoided some of the mold and moisture problems. The other green rehab elements here, they use a high efficiency geothermal heating and cooling system, so there's an important heating recovery that I'll point out in a moment. Enhanced insulation of the building envelope, Energy Star appliances, water conservation, cement fiber siding, interior finish materials using recycled content, and then on-site recycling of demolition and construction materials. And so this is what we found. We found that general health improved from 30, these are people who reported very good or excellent health, increased from 33% to 62%, and the P thing means that we're 95% sure that this is in fact a real finding. We also saw dramatic improvements in chronic bronchitis from 10% to 0%, hay fever, sinusitis, asthma in adults. This is in adults. These data are for adults. And then hypertension, which was frankly a little surprising to me. That one was marginally significant. I would point out this was a relatively small sample size. We only had 50 households, basically. So the fact that we were able to demonstrate statistically significant improvements, at least from a scientific standpoint, is especially noteworthy. For children, also found an improvement in general health, but it did not achieve the 95% statistical significance, but still it went up from 53% to 65%. Respiratory allergies declined, Surprisingly, ear infections, which might be related to the bronchitis issue, also improved. Doctor diagnosed eczema, which is an important issue. It's, in some ways, we know it's related to asthma. Also declined substantially from 23% to 0%. Only two children in this cohort had asthma, so we did not see a change in those two children in regard to asthma findings. And then in terms of self-reports from residents, they told us that it was much easier to clean, it was more comfortable, it was safer, both in terms of the housing unit itself and the neighborhood, and that their children played outside more often. Some of this is just not rocket science. Part of the rehab involved putting a new playground in. So they played outside more often. That may have important influences for the obesity epidemic. Fewer people reported that they had moisture problems, from 29 to 4%. Evidence of water dampness due to broken pipes, leaks, and heavy rain from 39 to 18%. And the need for a dehumidifier or a humidifier both improved. That's because the ventilation system was planned. It wasn't left to the usual situation we have in our houses, which is where we just rely on leakage or people opening or closing their windows. It was planned. The residents also reported fewer problems with cockroaches, and they also reported a lower use of insecticides, which would influence the neurological effects of many pesticides. And that was also true for exterminators. I would point out the building management was quite happy because they didn't have to pay for routine monthly spraying anymore. They could get by with this integrated pest management. And then fewer problems with mice or rats. Fewer people also reported there was smoke inside their residence. It declined from 54 to 36%. And then these are a few of the lessons learned with regard to ventilation. I know this is a little busy, but if you look at the right-hand column, we found it's like any rehab job you've been on, it doesn't always work the way you designed it to. So we only achieved 70% of the fresh air flow rate required by ASHRAE. We found that the kitchen fans exhausted a little more than necessary, and the bathroom fans didn't exhaust quite as well. We also found that duct leakage was too high. That's because the contractor didn't use the mastic on the ducts, and that causes moisture problems in many respects, so they had to go back and seal them up. So the important message here is you got to commission these buildings after you're done to make sure they work the way in which you designed them to. Radon mitigation turned out to be a lesson learned. We found that initially some of the designers thought that if we seal up the building and we seal up some of the cracks in the basement, the radon wouldn't get in. And someone said that's unlikely to be true because of the pressure differentials. But so we did the post testing and found the levels were still above the EPA limits. We installed after the rehab a radon mitigation system, and you see that all the readings were well below. Actually, the EPA limit is 4 picocuries per liter. We were well below 2 at the end of the mitigation. But if we had done it as part of the rehab, we would have saved a lot of money. Retrofitting these things actually turns out to be much more expensive. We measured carbon dioxide and volatile organic compounds. The VOCs were all below the minimum risk levels. The CO2 levels, we usually use a benchmark of about 1,000 parts per million as a measure of fresh air supply. You'll note that we were close to that, probably because the fresh air system didn't work the way in which we had designed it to. If we'd brought in more fresh air, you'd have lower CO2. It's important to note these are not hazardous levels in their own right. And I'm not going to skip. I think I've actually said most of this. Now, here's the other thing that happened. We measured energy and water consumption and found that there was a 46% reduction in energy use. So not only did we improve health, we also improved the energy use and, as a result, the CO2 emissions from power plants. These calculations, I would point out, were done by the Center for Sustainable Building Research at the University of Minnesota, which was one of our partners. And let me just pause for a moment to note, this is a unique partnership. To my knowledge, this is the only housing study I'm aware of that a health foundation helped to fund. And I think that's noteworthy. It speaks to the sort of historic separation of these two worlds and the fact that many of us now recognize they need to come together. And as policymakers, I would urge you to think through, well, how can we best facilitate that improved collaboration in the future so that we do these rehab jobs in a smart way. One other quick study, this is new construction in public housing out in Seattle. This is the only other study to evaluate health outcomes from green building design, and these are some of the things that were done in that study. The reason they were called Breathe Easy homes is because these homes were targeted to asthmatic children. And you see, many of these things were the same types of things we did in Worthington, Leviosi paints, new windows that are energy efficient, fresh filtered air ventilation systems, airtight walls so that we have less odor migration, moisture removing fans, insulated foundation, and so forth. And this is what they found. And I realize now, I thought this was more of a seminar, but if you look at the far right hand column, the home triangle means the change in home measures, and you see that they showed a significant improvement in symptom-free days for every two-week period of 4 days. That is, these children were free of asthma symptoms for nearly 5 days out of every two-week period. That's enormous. Caretakers' quality of life also improved. The percentage reduction in the use of urgent clinical care, that is, trips to the emergency room, improved by 41%. Pretty substantial. And an asthma trigger exposure simply means the measured levels of allergens in settled house dust also improved in a statistically significant fashion. So these two studies together make a pretty compelling case that when you rehab green, it is in fact healthy. Now, before these studies were done, frankly, there was sort of good reason to believe that this was the case. But the reason we've launched these and a few other studies now is because we thought the evidence, frankly, was not all that clear, and we need to build the evidence base so that we can in fact proceed with confidence. We did that in the lead poisoning prevention field. We studied how we were doing lead hazard control to build that confidence for the Congress and for others who actually appropriate the money. So to conclude, there is now sufficient scientific evidence to improve housing and community interventions to improve health and prevent disease, housing-related disease and injuries. We still have research needs that remain. If I wouldn't be doing my job as a director of research if I didn't call for more research. But these cross-sectoral integrated policies that enable individual programs to get the biggest bang for the buck are essential. We still face some of that. You heard from the weatherization program just now. One of the things we are still doing today is that we have lead programs replacing windows that have lead paint on them. They're using the cheapest, energy-inefficient windows they can find because they want to maximize the number of housing units that are made lead-safe. We have weatherization programs who are not replacing windows because that's not the best way to... it doesn't rise to the top of the stack of things you can do in a house to make it energy-efficient. And yet, if you were to combine both programs, step back from each of those silos and ask, well, what makes sense that would benefit our society as a whole? We could achieve energy conservation and health improvements if we were to mandate those programs to replace windows with high energy efficient windows. So promoting that cross-sectoral collaboration is clearly the way to go. It's easier said than done. The policy implications, in my view, are that we're now talking about the high cost of health care and health insurance. We have a housing crisis in the form of the mortgage and affordable housing shortage. We're talking about getting people back to work. And I think, therefore, that healthy housing, green development, and climate change, they're all part of the same coin. And we need to figure out ways to weave them together in a way that will make sense. So individually, they're big problems. But if we can think through how to put them together, it seems to me we have an unprecedented opportunity here to make some significant progress. At the end of the day, substandard housing and disinvestment in our communities, it's not sustainable, it's not affordable in the end because these communities decline, and it's certainly not healthy. So hopefully we can find ways to do that. This is where you can find me. I'm pleased to be here, and down the road, if I can be of further assistance, I will do so. We're looking actually at doing another study here in Minnesota to look at another aspect of this issue, which has to do with elderly housing and some of the green retrofits. And frankly, understanding elderly housing and some of those other issues is harder methodologically. But let me stop now. I've probably gone way over my time, and ask if there are questions or comments.
Thank you, Dr. Jacobs. I do have a question, and that is, was there a set of standards that you used in the establishing the green building for the projects that you studied?
Yeah, these
and
were
what
the,
were they?
Yeah, these are standards that were developed by Enterprise Foundation, or it's called Enterprise Community Partners now, I believe. But those are the standards that we use. Those were frankly developed for the low-income housing world. I sat on the D.C. Green Building Task Force that recently passed the Green Building Law in D.C., and there was a debate about which green standards to use, and there are a number of them out there, but we settled on using the enterprise system.
Thank you for your studies. I really appreciate it. This committee in the House is actually called the Public Health and Housing Committee, so we are kind of on to what you're talking about a bit. Is the study that was done in Seattle, is that your study as well?
No, that's done by Dr. Jim Krieger. He's with the chief epidemiologist at the Seattle King County Health Department. His study is published in the peer-reviewed literature. Ours is about to be submitted here. We just wrapped it up.
One of the reasons I ask is I know that they had, I can't quite make out the word, but it looks like some sort of linoleum flooring.
Marmoleum.
Marmoleum, whatever. I'm not sure what that is. It's a kind of linoleum, I presume, that's not high-end VOC content.
Right. It's low in VOC content. It's a naturally occurring product. I'm not exactly sure what it's made out of, to be perfectly honest, but it doesn't require the same sorts of volatile organic adhesives and off-gassing that you would find with some of the regular products, and it also doesn't contain polyvinyl chloride.
One of the reasons I ask, and maybe it's something you can consider in your next study here in Minnesota, because I'm kind of on a campaign to get rid of these kinds of carpets everywhere in housing, and public housing for elders is one of the places too. Elders have asthma, they have emphysema, they have all kinds of housing issues, and we're still seeing that in many of our public housing. I'm just on a bonding trip in Minnesota, you know, and we still have not. When we rehab some of the units, they put have them putting carpeting back in. Now, Minnesota Housing Finance Agency has some new standards that are green and so on. But I just want to say, I mean, I think one of the things I'd really noticed in this study is that there was no carpeting in the wet areas. But the problem is children, and you know, the carrying around the food and everything else. Every area is a wet area, really, in most people's homes. So I'm just would ask you to at least look into the issue of alternatives to carpeting, especially for children with asthma or children who, you know, are going to inhabit a building who could have asthma.
Yeah, the evidence on carpeting is in certain ways conflicting because there is an issue having to do with falls and hard surfaces, as well as the ability of carpet fibers to bind particulate matter. And we published a brief on that. So it's certainly clear in wet rooms. There's no doubt that you should not put carpets into bathrooms and kitchens. Bedrooms, there are studies that actually go both ways with regard to asthma outcomes. People are quite passionate on this issue. It's certainly something that we should look at. Certainly in basements also is another area where the evidence is pretty clear. Carpets do not belong, and that's included in the enterprise standards. But for bedrooms and living areas and possibly stairs, it's, you know, there are arguments to be made both ways. And the expert panel actually was quite conflicted on that very issue. So it's an area, I think, for further investigation. But we do know enough to make sure it's not in certain areas.
Just one last thing. If you could share that evidence with us, I'd
sure. I'd be pleased to do that.
Representative Shaler?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I didn't mean to be asking so many questions today, but they keep coming up. So, Dr. Jacobs, I would just like to refer back to slide, I think it's number 4, on page 4, regarding the pesticides and the studies that were done. I'm just wondering, do you know where those studies were done? Were those done with regard to, you know, residential housing where you would be looking at pesticides such as lawns, mosquito control, things like that? Or were any of the studies done in rural areas where homes were adjacent to agricultural areas with crop spraying?
Yeah.
Do you know what that makeup was?
Yeah, Asa Bradman from Berkeley has done a number of studies of agricultural pesticide migration into residential structures. And the other major studies that have been done in this are out of Columbia University in New York City, which is basically looking at pesticide use in high-rise multifamily housing. And then there have been a large number of studies, and in Boston also, there have been a number of studies looking at, in public housing, looking at the use of integrated pest management and reduced insecticide use. Is that what the question was? It was agricultural migration?
Right.
Yeah. The only one I know offhand, and I can get more to you, is Bradman studies out of out in California. He also found significant migration of agricultural pesticides, particularly among farm workers, obviously, into residential structures. He also found DDT and other banned pesticide uses were still actually fairly high in the indoor environment.
Senator Rummel?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick comment. I think you'd be happy to know that when we did create our stimulus package for energy, that we require that all windows that are replaced have to be high efficiency lead-free windows.
So is it required that they replace windows?
When window replacement is,
right,
is required.
Yeah.
That they can't simply put in the cheapest model, as you explained. That I believe it's in our bill that mm-hmm. it must be the high energy efficient.
Oh, great.
Representative McFarland? I'm sorry. Representative Scott, I'm sorry.
This is a follow-up to Representative Saylor's question regarding the pesticide drift. And you mentioned this study was from a person, a doctor from California. Was the study conducted in California? Or?
Yes.
Okay. I just don't see that maybe as being as, I don't know. There aren't as many wide open spaces in California as you get out here in the Midwest, and the quality of air there is already terrible. I understand, you know, pesticides going to show up as pesticides, but I just wondered if that was really the most ideal place to do a study like that.
California is obviously a big agricultural producer as well, and the communities that were studied were largely farm worker communities, not big cities. I should have been clear about that, I guess. Is that where you were going? The question was whether the studies were done in big cities versus or urban areas versus agricultural areas,
well,
right?
I figured they were done in agricultural areas because they were using agricultural pesticides, but I just, you know, I think I have a different view of what California is really like, and I was curious as to, you know, it just seems like we have more wide open spaces here in the Midwest than California does, but, you know, the study's been done in California. So.
Thank you. Representative Bryan?
Okay. Thank you, Chair. I want to also thank you, testifier, for bringing the kind of interface between health and housing together for us in this way. I really appreciate your insight. I thought of asking this question earlier, and then maybe it's just more of a comment than a question, but because it doesn't really apply necessarily to the point that you're making, but there is also, I think, a connection between access to good health care and the ability to stay in housing. There are, I think, people who end up being homeless because they can't get medications that help maintain their independence. And I'm curious to know if there's any research or study being done into that area as well.
We were talking about this at lunch, actually, and there is a study that I believe shows that somewhere around 30% of foreclosures are due to either lack of health insurance or high medical bills that cannot be paid and therefore have a housing burden. And the if you look at Harvard's State of the Nation's Housing Report, it basically shows that if you're in the lower 25th quartile of income and you spend more than half of your income on housing, you have on average about $400 a month left for everything else, including food, medicine, clothing, and the rest. So there's, and that was before we had, that was from 06, I believe. So that was before we had this downturn, and I'm sure those numbers now are even more stark. So clearly, you know, you're right. There's a connection with the other side of this. I maybe might mention very briefly a new study we're launching in Chicago that looks at Medicaid data before and after public housing residents moved out of this sort of very severe public housing into new green housing. And the question is, did the Medicaid data, do they show that a decline use in medical expenditures after the move into the new improved housing. We're just starting it. It goes back actually 10 years now. So we'll hopefully have some new data. But it's sort of similar to the British study. We need to put a dollar value on these home investments and what you can actually recover from those health investments in housing in terms of avoided health care costs.
Dr. Jacobs, I have a question, and that is based on access to limited funding that the states have. Are we better off doing a complete green housing rehab on less units, or doing some kind of piecemeal on the units that we already have and get more of the units done in order to save money? So you want to throw a softball at you.
Yeah, it's always a tough call, isn't it? I would point to what happened with the lead experience in the mid-90s. The housing folks said, if you make us do this lead stuff, we're going to end up doing 10% fewer rehabs. And our mission is to make sure that poor people have roofs over their heads. And we looked at the data and said 10% is about right. And so we went to Congress and said, we need to increase the rehab budgets. It's not enough to just issue this mandate to control lead hazards in housing. We should find a way to pay for it. And Congress did, in fact, increase HUD's rehab budget back then to accommodate those increased costs. What I'm trying to say here today is we're already paying for these things now. But they're borne by the medical care sector. And so since we're already paying for it, the question is, well, where should we properly be paying for it? Should we pay for it at the front end and help to reduce those exposures, or not? The other lesson to be learned on this question was from the lead exposure field as well. In the early, before we understood what a lead hazard was, the method was to remove all lead paint from U.S. housing. And the price tag for that was $600 billion. Mm-hmm. So that produced paralysis. And it wasn't until we understood the pathways of exposure based on scientific research that we were able to say, okay, you don't have to remove all the lead paint, but you do have to control lead hazards in the form of deteriorated paint, contaminated dust, and bare soil. If you do those three things, you can drive down exposure. Now, it's still costly, but it's nowhere near $600 billion. It was more like $20 billion. And that's something you could, as a nation, we could get our arms around. So I think the same kind of thing needs to be done here. We need to understand what the housing needs are. We need to understand the prevalence of health-related hazards in those houses, put a price tag on that, and then figure out, you know, how we pay for that from both housing and health resources, and then do the smart thing.
President Blythe, do you have another question? Dr. Jacobs, thank you very much. It was very enlightening, and appreciate your time.
Thank you all.
To move on to the tools for assisting the housing crisis. And we have Monica Nelson, Board President of Minnesota Coalition for the Homeless. Thank you for being here.
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, and committee members, I'll edit my remarks in essence of time. I am Monica Nelson, the board president of the Minnesota Coalition for the Homeless. It is a statewide organization of 150 agencies serving homeless or at-risk of homelessness people. I am also day-to-day the director of street outreach at St. Stephen's Human Services in Minneapolis, working with the Minneapolis Police Department and the downtown business community. Most specifically with people who are sleeping outside or people who are involved in public issues of homelessness. I'd like to tell you about some emergency resources or how the lack of emergency resources affect the people I work with and provide some information for you or your staff when you encounter households who are in an emergency situation. I'd like to do that by way of telling you about a chihuahua, a backpack, and some bath towels. I don't want anyone here to be misled that by providing a phone number that the people you talk to will be helped. And I had brought a couple minutes of audio today of call after call of people who are seeking help that we can't help. what is hard for us as direct service people is that there's lots of information, there's lots of resources, you have stacks of them in front of you, but that doesn't mean that we have any more help. I will say that the stimulus money has filled some gaps that were left by one-time funding being cut last year, and I'll talk about that. But in other areas, the gaps were not filled. People don't choose to be homeless. And I just want to reiterate that for people who think that perhaps people are sleeping outside because they choose to be. Last Thursday, Wilder Research conducted a statewide surveying and count of households who are homeless in every district in the state. St. Stephen's conducted a surveying and count along with over 100 volunteers just in the Minneapolis and South Minneapolis area. On that one day, we counted 280 people without shelter. 280. That's a lot of people sleeping outside just in that small area. This morning, a man and woman came into our office and they asked me for a tent and some sleeping bags. And I said something that I couldn't believe the words came out of my mouth, but I said, can we find a bridge that you can sleep under instead of the woods? Because I don't have enough money for both a tent and two sleeping bags. So if I can get you two sleeping bags, that's what I can cover financially. But it's striking to me that we now have an office that's loaded with camping gear as an alternative form of emergency housing for people. But that's what we've created. And, you know, if we think that there is no spillover when we don't meet people's needs, this is the spillover. For a woman named Karen, who we are working with, a frequent panhandler, the Minneapolis Police Department asks all the time, what are you going to do about the panhandlers? Downtown Business asks, what are you going to do? This is an economic development issue. Well, fortunately, the stimulus money did help fill the gap that was lost in the Department of Public Safety for what was called the Police Homeless Outreach Project. That project in St. Louis, Ramsey, and Hennepin County works between street outreach workers and local police departments to address some of the public issues of homelessness. It's a way to get people, instead of calling the police or having the police handle everything with a ticket or jail, that we move towards a more positive response of housing. So for Karen and her chihuahua, Winston, we are able to use some stimulus money to get them into housing. That helps reduce panhandling, which helps in the economic development of our community. For others, we have these outreach cards, and they are something that in the metro we ask people to use when people say, can you spare some change? That is the question I get asked more than anything else. What do you say to people when they say, can you spare some change? My suggestion is that if you have one resource in your head, in your district or in the metro, that if you can say, call St. Stephen's for families or adults, or call the bridge for youth, that you're providing something of value to that person. For some, they have these cards at the liquor store register, at the business, at Brugger's Bagels, and they can pass these cards out to people. It's very handy and much smaller than something else that St. Stephen supplies, like a handbook of the streets for Minneapolis or St. Paul. These are good resources for people in the 7-county metro area, because while people may have their community action agencies in your district, that would probably be the first stop for people. In many areas, there is not emergency shelter, there's not an adequate supply of food, and many people migrate to the urban core or an urban area near them to seek service. It's not that everybody who was born homeless in St. Paul or Minneapolis. Mm-hmm. It's that they have to come there because they can't get help where they're from. And so for a lot of people, they use these resources, which are available at St. Stephen's, to at least get them some immediate help. With the impending loss of general assistance medical care, we are actively pursuing getting folks before what's called a state medical review team for insurance. Many people I work with who are in psychoses ask me when they won't have medical. I lie to them. And I say that they won't lose their medical. I say that either because I have to give them hope or because I have to believe in you and believe that the community will fix this before they lose their health care.
St. Stephen's was the recipient of HPRP funding that Michelle Smith from HUD spoke of to help move families into housing. That is help for someone like Amanda, who moved from being a homeless poor person to now a housed poor person. But Amanda still has to use bath towels as diapers some days when she doesn't have enough resources, either through a local food shelf or with her limited income. For Kevin, someone we're working with who's a college student, he is carrying all of his school supplies in his pocket. He has his homework rolled up, and he sticks that in his back pocket, and he has his books in a grocery sack. With the loss of funding from the Runaway and Homeless Youth Act, it's been more difficult to stabilize him. We're hopeful that for easy resources like 211, the United Way's call for help, that the public has at least a quick resource to give people. But I want to say that getting people connected to a homeless or housing advocate is the best thing that you can do. Because rather than give them a laundry list of resources, we can streamline that pretty quickly for them. Finally, I will just say that educating yourself is really the primary thing, and if you haven't done a tour of shelters or housing in your district or in the metro area, I would strongly encourage you to do so. I think once I were to take you to some of the camps or you were to visit some of the warehouse shelters, you would be strongly impacted and ready to take action. So thank you.
Thank you. Is there any questions? Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious, are you informing the folks that are concerned about losing their health care that they probably need to qualify for Minnesota Care and other programs, because about 90% of those folks that were on DAMC are going to be eligible for that program? So I'm just wondering if you were aware of that and if you were able to inform those folks of that.
I am aware of that. However, this is not the time yet to inform them of that, because if, for instance, they pursued it right now, there's a four-month lapse that they need to be uncovered with health care, and then there's also a $10,000 cap for hospitalization. So if I'm someone that uses the hospital, if I have illness like cancer and I'm on DAMC, I would be at great risk of floating without insurance and then getting a huge medical bill in the hopes that I'm going to gamble that. So it's still too early to pursue that.
Okay. I just wondered, because you said you had to lie to them and tell them that it wasn't going to, that they weren't going to have insurance, or that they would be covered, and I just felt like, well, I didn't know if you knew that or not, they would probably be covered under MPS.
Thank you. Representative Bly?
Your testimony bears on some of the questions that I asked the previous testifier as well, but I mean, I happen to know of some folks who live in insured sheltered situations and maybe are dealing with a psychosis and are on medications, and if they're going to lose those medications, and also the support they may get from a public health nurse or something like that who may help them keep track of their medications and stay on medication. I mean, we could see increased costs in people going into prisons or wherever they may be because they cannot maintain their behavior or their... So, I mean, I guess it does concern me a lot, which is the point you bring up, that there may be a lapse, even if they could get some coverage later on, there may be a lapse where there are a number of people who just don't get the treatment or the care that they need because of what's happened. So I appreciate your testimony.
Ms. Nelson, Representative Rosenwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much. And I think the testimony is compelling from everybody. And this is not something that is going away. In fact, it's growing worse every day. And the cuts to GAMC, I get letters still every day pleading to restore the program. And I think it's, to say that it's going to be picked up by Minnesota Care is a myth. Portions of it will be picked up, but the whole holistic person is not going to be picked up by Minnesota Care. And a lot of people are actually going to get thrown off Minnesota Care because the guidelines are going to be raised. So we have to be very careful when we talk about, you know, these people who are the poorest of the poor and the sickest of the sick are going to be taken care of, because hopefully they will, but a lot of people are hurting out there and they're not going to be covered. So I think we need to keep that in mind. And I want to thank you for your work, and it's inspiring.
Ms. Nielsen, my question is, of the homeless that come through St. Stephen's Shelter or through your organization, what percent of those, or approximate percentage, could you give me that really need supportive services, something other than a place to sleep and you know, an opportunity to get reestablished? By that I mean, you know, medical, somebody to monitor them for mental illness, physical disabilities, whatever.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, it's hard to give a percentage. For families, it's smaller than you would think. It's really an issue of affordable housing. With my project, working with people who are sleeping outside, they are in need of more support. But in general, I will say that people need less supportive housing than people might think. What we really need is more federally subsidized housing.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
We need to move on unless there's other questions. Thank you. We now have Kathleen Vitalis, Executive Director of Minnesota Assistant Council for Veterans. Thank you for coming.
Thank you, sir. Committee members, basically I echo everything that Monica just said, but I'm going to bring it down to very briefly where veterans are concerned, and especially in the state of Minnesota. And I'll also open with a quote. We're a National Guard family. Recently, my husband lost his job due to his active duty orders. This is being investigated through federal and state agencies, but we're about to be evicted, our utilities shut off. With the parents of triplet girls, we're frantic. He's lost a lot of wages due to his ignorant employer. Do you help people like us, or do you know who can? We are desperate. These are the calls that we get every day. And when you're talking about veterans, naturally, this particular case was investigated and solved, but what happened in the 4 or 5 months that took? And that's where my organization, Minnesota Assistance Council for Veterans, is a statewide nonprofit. Three offices, Duluth in the Metro and Mankato, and we've been around for 17 years, and we fill those gaps in funding and bring in additional resources to focus on homeless veterans and those in crisis and in danger. In Minnesota, there's about 410,000 veterans, and approximately 1% or over 4,000 will have an episode of homelessness this year. In the last Wilder survey, 624 were counted at that point in time, surveyed as being homeless. And in the single male homeless population, both nationally and following through to Minnesota, it's either 25% to 30% of single homeless men are veterans. And 32% of homeless veterans have served in a combat zone. And I have a lot of different statistics, but the key, I think, is stabilizing a homeless veteran. They do have access to things that civilians do not, federal and state benefits. And the real key that we try to focus on is increasing their income. If we can stabilize their housing and increase their income, we can bring in federal benefits into this state. And of the 870 veterans and their families that my staff of 12 helped last year, that we probably gained access for these veterans that did not and were not on any of their benefits, $6 or $7 million. And also, we have a program, again as a nonprofit, we can leverage some federal funding. The Department of Labor VETS program is an employment program just in the metro area. We've had that for several years. Last year, we employed 121 from street homeless to stabilized and employed veterans that resulted in gross wages of close to $4 million. So when you can focus on these situations and leverage resources and work together, things can happen. But it is getting worse. And in particularly when you're looking at veterans, I wanted to... The OEF-OIF, Operation Enduring Freedom, Operation Iraqi Freedom, you'll know them as Afghanistan and Iraqi veterans. Approximately 1.7 million have deployed, 34% have deployed multiple times. You know, the issues that they're having as they reintegrate and coming back into our state are many. So just this segment of veterans, we are seeing
obviously on the increase of needing services. Female veterans make up about 15% of the military. They're also about 10 to 12% of the homeless that we serve right now. That's on the increase. So there are, I saw that Michelle Smith talked this morning from HUD. Did she talk about HUD VASH vouchers?
Mm-hmm.
The HUD VASH, I mean, on the horizon, there are some really good things that are being done from the federal level down through the states. HUD VASH is HUD VA Supportive Housing Vouchers. Basically, think of it as a Section 8 for a veteran. It is a VA case-managed Section 8. We have, excuse my note, but I wanted to get this right. In Minnesota, currently, we have 35 of these vouchers that are managed through St. Cloud and the St. Cloud VA, and we have 105 vouchers through the Minneapolis VA, some for St. Paul, and then for Minneapolis. It's a good program. It had some implementation issues that we're all working on together because it has taken, in our estimation, way too long to get these things going. I mean, you know, when you talk about the individuals that we serve, they can't wait 3 to 4 months for services because as they wait, things get a lot worse for them. So we are accessing all the programs that there are, both federally and down through the state. My particular organization, we also have built and coordinated our own housing. We've got permanent housing through Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, HUD, GMIS, CSH. We've got projects, an ongoing project in Duluth. We're doing what we can to utilize resources to provide more housing. But sadly, of course, it is not enough for the things that we are seeing. And we work very closely with all our partners and collaborators. And if it comes to veterans and you have any specific questions, I'd be happy to answer them. But I know we're short on time.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry to ask so many questions, but I'm just curious. You said that the income levels have to go up to a certain point. What is that point?
Income level. I said if when you're working with veterans, they have access to things that can increase their income levels, which are basically zero, that civilians do not have, which are their veteran benefits.
Okay, I misunderstood you there. I thought you said that they had to bring their incomes up to a certain level before they're eligible. I'm like, well, isn't that backwards? No, okay, I misunderstand it.
Okay, thank you.
Ms. Vitalis, is there any veteran-specific homeless shelters or facilities that you're able to access that the general public could not?
That the general public?
Specifically for the veterans.
Well, we have a VA grant and per diem that is for veterans only, and it's a per diem 13-bed homeless facility, so you do have to be a veteran to be eligible for those 13 beds. But otherwise, we utilize the shelter system and work and coordinate with that.
Okay. And is that located in the metro?
That 13-bed facility is on the VA Medical Center campus. It's been around for 17 years. It's our first program, sir.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions? Then we have Cheryl Peterson with the Mortgage Foreclosure Prevention Program Manager, Twin Cities Habitat for Humanity.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I want to give some information about what our program does. But at Twin Cities Habitat for Humanity, we actually have multiple housing programs. So I'm going to give some additional information about our other programs and services as well. So essentially what our Mortgage Foreclosure Prevention Program does is we help homeowners in the city of Minneapolis. We negotiate with mortgage companies on behalf of homeowners, in addition to giving them financial counseling and resources that might be able to help them prevent foreclosure. So a big part of what we do is really being the mediator between the homeowner and the mortgage company or mortgage servicer. So I'd like to actually say thank you for passing the postponement legislation last year. We've actually been able to postpone dozens of fair sales over the past couple of months due to that legislation. And in addition to that, there's actually the government initiative Making Home Affordable that came out back in March. Probably about half of our current caseload has actually been able to get on child modification plans with that initiative. And in the past week, we've actually finally after months of waiting, been able to get two loan modifications finalized through that government initiative. So there really has been some programs that have came out that have been able to help homeowners that we see in our program. Unfortunately, there are still many homeowners that were not able to actually prevent their foreclosure. And so a lot of barriers standing in the way would be unemployment and basically lack of affordability in the current property. So when we're working with a homeowner, we want to make sure that whatever we're able to work out with the mortgage company is going to be long-term affordable to that homeowner. And if somebody comes to our program and they don't have enough income to sustain that household long-term, we're going to basically give them advice on the foreclosure process as well as letting them know that they're going to need to increase their income. And unfortunately, right now, there really aren't any programs directly through servicers that they're offering for those individuals. But on average, about 60% of the people that we actually see in person were able to actually prevent their foreclosure. So we do actually have a fairly high success rate. In addition to our foreclosure prevention program, we also have our homeownership program, which is, I think, probably what most people think of when they think of Twin Cities Habitat for Humanity. So we serve home buyers who are at 50% of the area median income in the 7-county metro area. In addition to our homeownership program, we also have a program called A Brush with Kindness. A Brush with Kindness is essentially a volunteer-based program that helps low-income families do minor household repairs and painting in the properties. A high percentage of the population that they serve are seniors and disabled individuals. So with that said, is there any questions?
President Hayden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for testifier. I told Representative Carlson I would make sure I followed up on his question. He couldn't be here. But I think that the question that we have is, you said that 60% of the loans were modified or successfully avoided foreclosure. Does that also include modification, short sales? I mean, is that more than just them being able to stay in their house and get a new loan?
It is. It actually includes basically any thing that would prevent them from actually being foreclosed on. So if they sold their property while working with our program, we would also count that as a successful outcome. The majority of that 60% is probably modifications or forbearance plans through their servicer, but not all.
Good, Mr. Chair. Just follow up. There's been an awful lot in the paper and just a lot of clamoring. I think you were at the same event that I was at that talked about people having a Dickens of a time working with their lender or their mortgage servicer in order to get the modification. And so, though the government has set up a program that helps to, that potentially could help them modify their loan, we heard nightmare stories of people having to call their lender 10 times, being put on hold multiple times, getting a deal that was worse than the deal that they already have. Can you comment on that issue? And that seems to have really come to light that the program isn't working as well because the lenders aren't part-time on that issue. And that seems to have really come to light that the program isn't working as well because the lenders aren't participating the way that they should.
Yeah, I definitely can comment on that. That's actually a lot of what my counselors actually do. So I have a staff of 6 counselors, once again, that we serve the city of Minneapolis. A big part of what they do is actually follow up with the mortgage company, and typically before we even get a release and we're able to talk to them, we probably have to call on average, I would guess, 3 to 5 times, maybe even more. And then after that, it's just a matter of following up every 1 to 2 weeks to see what they're willing to offer. And then once they do come to the table with an offer, then we negotiate to try to make sure that it's going to be in that homeowner's best interest. And with making home affordable, most of our clients that actually got on the trial modification, so with that program, they basically have to make payments for 3 months before the servicer would actually permanently modify the loan. And most of those plans that once the program started came out April and May, somewhere around there. So most of the plans ended around August or September. And so we definitely have a lot of homeowners sitting and waiting for those modifications to actually come through. But with that said, so we spend a lot of time on the phone. I would venture to guess 50% of the time that my staff spend is probably on the phone on hold or actually talking to a department, getting transferred to another department, or just having miscommunications with the mortgage servicers. So, yes, that is definitely an issue.
Just one more follow-up, Chair. So what is the percent? I mean, that's incredible. We talk about 30% of our health care being used in administrative costs, and we're trying to figure that out. Now we have 50% in administrative costs just to get the loan modified or something that the government said. Anyways, that being said, what is the percentage, do you think, of loans that get modified through the program going through this whole process? So 60% includes a lot of things, but really kind of trying to, and I know you may not have it in front of you, but trying to narrow it down of successful modification programs that your organization works with, getting through the 3-month trial period and then getting a new loan, regardless if it's new terms or more years on the loan, et cetera. How many, what, can you give us a ballpark of what's been successful?
I'm going to say it actually probably varies at any one point in time. Now, of the cases that we're able to actually prevent foreclosure, I'm going to guess probably anywhere from 30 to 40% of the foreclosures that are prevented are probably modifications, maybe a little bit higher. A year ago, it would have probably been lower. That's actually a statistic I looked at, I think, back in 2007 or so, and it was probably only about 5% of our clients had actually gotten modifications. And the thing is, with loan modifications, they definitely have gotten better. So typically, right now, the media has really publicized the term modification, and most individuals think that it actually means lowering the payment. A modification is actually just any change in terms to a mortgage. That can actually mean an interest rate increase. It doesn't have to mean a decrease. And so modifications that we were getting a year or two ago typically just added on and capitalized the delinquent mortgage payments onto the principal balance, which actually meant that mortgage payments increased rather than decreased. Whereas now, we're really able, if a mortgage company comes to us and says, okay, the payment's going to increase, we go back to them and say, no, that's not okay. And 9 times out of 10, we can get it lowered rather than having an increase in payment. So that's something that's changing, but it's not across the board that all modifications are going to be long-term affordable. And so that's something that we stress when we get an agreement. If it's not affordable, don't sign the document. And let's try to go back to the table, even if it takes an additional 3 months to do that, to get something that's going to be affordable.
Thank you.
Ms. Peterson, is Habitat working statewide or and with other organizations?
We actually are. Twin Cities Habitat just serves the 7-county metro area. There's actually Habitat affiliates throughout Minnesota that have different areas that they build in.
And they're doing the counseling service as well?
They are not. So Habitat is actually part of the statewide network through the Minnesota Homeownership Center. So we're actually, I believe, the only Habitat affiliate that actually does foreclosure prevention.
Thank you. Representative Clark?
I think this committee is very, people who have been dealing with this are very frustrated and, you know, would be very interested in specific suggestions for legislative change that you might have. So I would invite you either beginning now or in the next couple months, really help us look at specific changes that we can try to make at the state level, because we are dealing with incredible frustration from our constituents and the things that you talked about. That I can think of 2 cases where they actually ended up worse. And it's just unacceptable. So if you're kind of alone in being able to generate some pressure successfully in many cases, it sounds like, I think we'd like to hear how we could join you in making that more systemic.
I definitely have suggestions.
Representative Benson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to follow up on some of these questions, I've heard it discussed by some observers of this phenomenon of foreclosure, that in spite of the federal program that has been promulgated, that it actually is simpler and easier for companies and banks simply to foreclose than to go through the process of renegotiating these loans. Is there any truth to that notion? Do especially large banks or companies that you know have bundled these loans and so and sent them off in this process that we've seen on Wall Street simply find it easier to foreclose on people? They don't have to deal with these individuals, and they simply let the process go through. Have you run across any of that?
Yeah. So I actually think, well, any mortgage servicer, which is entity that we deal with, their goal is basically to collect the money on a loan, and any securitized loans are actually going to have mortgage agreements that actually state exactly what they can and can't do. And so whether that means to go into foreclosure or do a loan modification, that mortgage servicer still actually has to follow the agreement that they actually have with the entity who's the investor or whatever pool that security is in. So as far as it being more difficult for them to modify versus foreclose, I don't actually think that's the case because they still have to adhere to that agreement. I think that that's something that we hear servicers saying. So, for example, they'll say the investor doesn't allow it, and then we ask, who's the investor? Give us the number of this securitized agreement that you're referring to. Show us what you're talking about. And usually if you actually go that far, then they'll take a step back and say, okay, we'll look into it again. So, and overall, foreclosing on a property is very costly. And so I would actually hope that those investors, whoever they may be, would want to do what's in their best financial interest, which typically is going to be to reduce the terms of that loan to make it long-term affordable rather than foreclosing on the property. Not to mention just the large amount of properties that are sitting around vacant that those lenders aren't able to sell because of the market, and they're sitting on those properties and they're still having to pay costs post-redemption period, so property taxes and insurance and securing the property. And those are definite costs that I would think the investor or lender wouldn't want.
But there has to be an explanation for why there are so many foreclosures and why the financial institutions have not been moving on this in spite of the federal program. To me, there's a kind of a disconnect between those investors who've purchased these bundled mortgages and so forth, and even the banks or the institutions who are being forced to or foreclose on people. And to me, the federal program has not dealt with that. There has to be an explanation for why we're having all these foreclosures when there would be this alternative. So it must be to the advantage of at least somebody in this chain to simply force the foreclosures. They simply want the money, don't they? Because they're under pressure. They have to come up with a payment to their stockholders. And so the individual here at, you know, ground level is simply grist for the mill. That's how I see this. And to me, it doesn't seem that the federal program has the teeth to force negotiations on the part of these institutions.
They don't. Well, actually, with making home affordable, it's actually the mortgage servicers, not the investors, who are actually participating in it.
That's right.
And so if they don't have full authority, like you're talking about, that is correct. They can't modify.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Ms. Peterson, for your testimony. Next is Shannon Guernsey from Minnesota Housing Partnership, who I have to commend for the wonderful organization she did in putting this group of testifiers together for us, and her staff. And please conclude.
Happy to. And I will be brief, just a couple of minutes. The point of this last panel, I think it was really important, at least from my perspective, to have some of the testimony and some of the comments that you just heard provided to provide the context of some of these referrals.
I'll just alert you, you might want to just make sure that you keep at hand this particular page. It's front and back. It has web links as well as phone numbers that you can refer folks to. We do know that either you or your staff are getting calls about constituents in need and with concerns. And so we tried to think about what would be some referral resources. But as this panel has definitely articulated, is even referring them on, we do have a tremendous amount of need and demands out there due to the amount of homelessness, a lack of affordable housing and such. So just to keep it in that context. So hopefully some of these resources, most of them, though, I will just alert you to what I have on the screen here. This is the Home Ownership Center that Cheryl mentioned. And I'd also just like to reiterate what Monica said, which was one of the best things that we can do as referring folks who are asking for assistance is to connect them with an organization who knows how to both connect them to maybe housing or resources, but also to serve as an advocate. And here, the Home Ownership Center, I'd refer you there because you can go to any of these, click on any of these counties that you have here and find out who is delivering the foreclosure counseling services in that county. So this is interactive. The next one I would also bring you to is Housing Link. Again, that's provided here on this sheet. It also has a pretty significant list, that big blue dot up there. You would click on that, and that your constituent could click on that and find out information, how to qualify for public housing and eligibility, Section 8 and vouchers around the state, other Housing Link and affordable housing resources that are available. So again, if you're going to send some folks, these are some really helpful referral resources, we hope. In addition, you see on the left-hand side some clicks. We have known that in this market, we've had some issues definitely around renters. In your packet, there is a flyer that speaks to what renters need to know if their landlord goes into foreclosure. Also have contact information for home line and legal aid. So if you have renter needs, you can also click here on the Housing Link page. The next one that I'll just bring you to and was also mentioned are the community action agencies. This too, if you go online here, it's an interactive map. You can click on your county and you can find out who is that CAP agency that's providing just services and trying to keep up with the need in their community. So we just wanted to, again, provide some context for these referrals, but also equip you with what, as from our view, were some valuable resources that you and your staff could help get good information to folks. And again, to the extent that you connect them with these organizations who are able to sit with them as they're negotiating or needing to speak with lenders about modification, if they're needing to connect with organizations to find housing or veteran services, that they are out there, and if we connect them with those folks, they will hopefully find some folks who can help them along the way and get to a better situation. So that concludes my remarks. So thank you.
Thank you very much. I would like to encourage all the agencies that have testified and all the folks that are also interested in trying to help us get through this these housing issues over the next year or so to please try to give us some ideas on policy changes that might save us money or do a better job or eliminate some mandate that makes it more difficult for you to do your jobs as well. We're interested in trying to help the situation. I had a request that Gene Lee testify. We were going to keep it to, if you can keep it short. We're already over by almost a half an hour. I hope you have something to add to the conversation that we've been in, information sharing. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you. I'm Jean Lee. I represent a number of different agencies for this purposes. I'm President and Executive Director of Children's Hope International, R&R Family Centers, and a member of the Asian Pacific American Housing Consortium. I just wanted to point out, in answer to Representative Hayden and Representative Carlson's issues on how to help some of these people, Hope Now, which was part of the Neighborhood Work America
effort back in June of this year brought together bankers specifically for the purposes of modifying loans. In other words, so they invited people who were having problems with foreclosure and are on the verge of foreclosure to sit down and work things out. We don't have any information as to how successful they were as far as the true modifications of those loans. However, where I've seen success is where banks and services are forced to make modifications either through the court systems or through policy changes. But part of the caution in that is that whatever they feel they have lost in terms of options by eating some of the mortgage and interest, they have made up through other means, and some of us have seen our bank accounts change and our rates change as far as services being charged more. One area that banks have not been held accountable is an audit for efficiency and effectiveness. I think President Obama tried to do something similar with the auto industry, but that also should happen with the banks as far as cleaning up that system. I used to be a former banker, and I was a former corporate auditor, so I know there's changes there. And if policy-wise, there could be some type of formula that's acceptable to both the banks and the legislators as far as modifying loans down to a certain point that they're comfortable with, because otherwise it doesn't matter how many counselors you pay for or who you send them to, they cannot make a modification if the banks won't go for it. Other areas as far as dealing with the housing crisis that you can influence, zoning changes. I think a lot of us who, I don't know if it's just my generation or just my experiences, we're familiar with school dorms, we're familiar with barracks. Nowadays, seems to be a standard that you need these huge, large spaces. You can fit a lot of people in some of the spaces that, you know, one or two people currently sit in. And I think that requires some zoning changes and modifications of homes to enable more people to be fit in per square footage. Also going back to the idea that these people should not have pie-in-the-sky ideas of dream houses, and that's the house we should put them in, but the idea that they should start with what's affordable and the starter homes in smaller spaces. And I think that would go a long ways towards the affordability and housing the homeless. And then the last issue I wanted to raise as far as what Habitat was saying on the housing counseling side and foreclosure. The Homeownership Center last year said there were about 37 counselors statewide. Just to make a point, four of the Asian counselors are within different agencies as far as Washington County and some of these other agencies. Three are from Asian Pacific agencies. However, we are not in this particular network of referrals, so I think that referral listing and resources should be looked at for further inclusiveness as to who is out there really, because Minneapolis Urban League is another resource and a number of others who aren't in this network and being included. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Lane. Any questions? Thank you. Thank you for your patience and hanging on an extra half an hour from the original time frame. I think it was worthwhile. I appreciate you all being here, and this meeting's adjourned.